And now it's time for public comment. These are, this is the opportunity for members of the public to address the board on issues that are not on the agenda. Is there anyone here to speak?
My name is Deborah Taylor, and I am here to speak to you about Ashford Bridges Schools. I'm a neighbor there. I've been a neighbor there for over 30 years. And I have discovered recently that you're in the process of enclosing the entire field behind the school. This field, which flows seamlessly into Durfee Park, has simply been something that this community has used in, I believe, a very friendly way as long as I have lived there. And to shut people out from that area. I don't usually do this, but I cried when I saw it. It just felt wrong. For me to get to Durfee Park now, it is going to be very difficult. And the loss of that beautiful property is unnecessary. I have been told there was concern about the fact that the building is currently unoccupied and subject to vandalism, which I suppose it is, although that's the condition of pretty much all of these schools every summer. But what you are doing is not protecting your school in any way. That building is completely vulnerable under what you're doing to it. All you're doing is locking the school up in the field. If you were to put a fence around the building, you would perhaps create a situation that was more protective of it against vandalism, but that's not what you're doing. Anybody could walk up to that building directly and do this if they chose to. I can't walk through the field and enjoy time there with neighbors who walk their dog and whatnot. Someone mentioned to me a problem with dog poop, which I understand is an ongoing situation. I don't think it's that big of a deal that we need to eliminate the community from using that space. And I assure you that everybody who looks and sees dog poop, they're always seeing dog poop, they're also seeing cat poop, they're also seeing raccoon poop, and you're not going to be able to eliminate any of that. So this is just a strongly felt request on behalf of a neighbor that you treat this facility as a public space that is supported, in fact, by your community. You do have a gym there that is, you know, operated in conjunction with Parks and Rec. So the relationship of parks in that field, I think, goes back many years. It's really sad, and it doesn't need to happen. You're not protecting your building. You are locking your community away from a lovely space. Thank you.
Other members of the public?
Hello, I'm Jessica, this is Melissa, and this is Haley, and we are part of the Harvard High's AVID class, the senior AVID class. We're here to invite you guys to our AVID graduation, which will be taking place Wednesday, June 1st, in our NPR at 6 p.m. Our class of 30 seniors is very special to us. 98% of us are first-generation students, and 98% of us were accepted to four-year universities. We would love you to come enjoy dinner and take part in our celebration. Thank you so much.
As I shared before, the trustees have a board meeting that night, and it's not, they aren't coming not because they don't support you and think this is wonderful. It's just that there is another board meeting that we have next Wednesday, and unfortunately we'll miss your event, but congratulations.
Congratulations.
Are there other members of the public who would like to address the board?
Hello, my name is Steve Fenetis, and I serve as the president of the Santa Cruz Triathlon Association. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization based in Santa Cruz that is dedicated to supporting the triathlon community by providing a fun and friendly environment for learning and experiencing the sport triathlon. Our premier event is the annual Santa Cruz Triathlon, formerly known as the Sentinel, which we've been running for 33 years. We run it for 33 years to raise funds for local athletic programs in Sturdy, including the Santa Cruz City High School teams. The race requires an army of volunteers, from club members to students, to run to be successful. Students from selected schools, including Soquel High School, serve as race day volunteers and receive grants based on the success of our fundraising efforts. The more money we raise and the lower our costs, the more schools receive in donations. During our 33 years, we've raised over $1.5 million, which we put back into the county. And last year alone, we donated over $7,500 to the three Santa Cruz City high schools. So I hope we can continue on our relationship for another 33 years. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Any others? Thank you all very much. Superintendent report.
I just wanted speaker on the Natural Bridges campus. I'm going to try and see if I can find her. We are going to have a gate in that fence that's in the back of the campus, so neighbors will still have access to Derby Park. What we're trying to, we've had huge issues with damage being done to the field space because cars are being driven onto the campus and people are doing donuts on the fields. And it destroys the turf. So that is the concern, and protecting the campus as well. We had an arson incident, and we have found that when we fenced our campuses, it's made a tremendous difference in the amount of vandalism that we experience. This week, we had our retirement celebration, and I want to give special thanks to Molly and her team for a wonderful celebration of our retirees this last Monday night. 27 retirees were honored for many, many years of service to students and families in our community. I also wanted to talk a little bit more about the Natural Bridges site. Both the fire department and the police department are conducting trainings on the campus. The PD is out there a couple days a week doing trainings, and the fire department is going to start doing weekly trainings out on the site. So it's bringing, it's an important part of our partnership with our first responders. And we are grateful that they're able to have access to use it as a training facility right now. I'm also planning a neighborhood meeting at the Natural Bridges campus on June 2nd at 6 o'clock to dialogue with neighbors about the planning process and the future of the campus. Last Wednesday at the Civic Center, we had an amazing celebration of student achievement in music at the district music concert. Special thanks to our music teachers, Nick Bianchini, Greg Brown, Katrina Hager, Christy Latham, Maura Lorenberst, Jim Stewart, and Zena Urquhart. It was a great event. In addition, I'd like to express my gratitude to the Santa Cruz community for the parcel taxes that really support these exceptional programs. On Sunday, May 15th, we had a wonderful Gala Getza celebration. So many great things happening this time of year. I want to thank all of our teachers and leaders who were there to help out. And special thanks to school community, our school social worker Nareda Robles and community coordinator Faye Silva, retired principal Kurt Coleman, and assistant superintendent Meeker for their work with the Senderos program on this Gala Getza event. On Wednesday, our union leadership partners, Barry and Robert, and all of cabinet attended the school services update on the governor's May revise. With lower than expected state revenues in April, we saw a few changes in the budget, and Jim will get into more details with that later this evening. On Friday, GSCFT President Barry Kirshen, Secondary VP Casey Carlson, SCCCE President Robert Chakanaka, Board President Thompson, Assistant Superintendent Parks, and I all attended a second convening of the California Labor Management Initiative, and that's a whole mouthful. But the gist of it is we had an opportunity to talk again about effective collaboration. And we talked about that in terms of teacher retention, accountability, student achievement, and all kinds of ways that we can work together. We scheduled some time in August to plan a day where we can get site leaders together with union rep and building reps to have a conversation about how does collaboration support student achievement, how does collaboration support teacher retention and employee retention, and just effective school climates and cultures. It was a good day, and I'm looking forward to our continued work together. Our S4C, Santa Cruz County College Commitment, is working together to honor our valedictorians and salutatorians, and announcing the colleges that our seniors will be attending. Look for that in the Sentinel, the Pajaronian, and the Valley Press in the next couple weeks. It should show up. The mission of S4C is to work collaboratively as a countywide TK16 system with all 10 TK12 districts and CSUMB, UCSC, and Cabrillo to ensure that all of our students are college and career ready, and we're excited to celebrate the success of our graduating classes.
Thank you, Chris. Student representative report.
Hello. It's been a while since my last report, like a month at this county, so a lot went on. Prom at Covenant Grove for Santa's High was amazing. It was really well done. Good job all around on that. The Spring Shakespeare Comedy of Errors went off without a hitch, which was really confusing for me because something always goes wrong and nothing went wrong. And I kept promising everyone that something would go wrong, and now people just think I'm paranoid. Our WASPs went really well. I'm sure you all know about that. APs happen. I don't know what more to say about that. Don't take 4 APs in a row. It's a bad idea. There aren't any new holes in the ceiling, so that's nice. But the girls' toilet flooded. I think that's the word for it. There was like stuff bubbling up out of the ground. So that got closed down, and then there were only 3 stalls for the girls in the main building, but the family staff bathroom, and the lines are really long, and that was awful. But now the bathroom's open again, so that's great. The lines are still long. Tomorrow night is the senior award night for Santa Cruz High, so that should be good. I'm hoping there's snacks. Speaking of awards, the Rotary Club recently recognized, I believe, 18 district kids at a scholarship luncheon, and like that was really inspiring to see that our senior class this year has a lot to be proud of. There's a new mural up on Mission Street. I don't know if you noticed it driving here, but I'm not sure if the Mission Hill kids were directly involved in that, but I know the art teacher there, Ms. Cruchetti, was. And like that was like a partnership with the Friends of State Parks. And it was like really cool to see like kids volunteering and putting that up and like more artwork in the community. I've been privy to some conversations regarding an initiative for a more climate literate student body, which is really interesting and kind of like touched on topics the AP environmental kids have been talking about earlier in the year. So I'm really excited to see how that develops going forward. And Free Speech Friday is back because there is no more testing to interrupt it. And we will be out front at San Jose High at 11:15 this Friday. And that's it.
I'm going to interject here and take this moment to ask Assistant Superintendent Meeker to recognize Ella for her service to the board this school year.
So at the heart of all the work we do is our students. And it's been a true privilege to have 2 of our students, their voices, as part of our board meetings. I want to take a moment just to recognize that both Aaron and Ella not only have brought reports to our meeting that represent what's going on in their schools, both the events, but also the questions and concerns that come up. But as you may see later on in the meeting, they also engage with the board reports and reminding us of the importance of the student perspective in our planning. And so I want to just say we're so grateful to you for your service and for your level of engagement, and to recognize you with not Aaron's certificate, but yours. I'm going to make her stand up for a quick photo op.
Thank you.
Who's not able to be here tonight, but also a very engaged student representative.
Thank you so much, Angela. Board reports.
On May 15th, I attended the CSBA Delegate Assembly, and a major part of the work that we did over the weekend was discussing how to make the LCF a template more user-friendly, both to districts creating their formula, creating their templates, but also to users trying to access the information. And CSBA will take all of our input and present to the School Board of Education in June. So hopefully we'll get some new ideas. And one idea I thought was really great was creating an interactive database that you can compare and contrast some more districts and see how things work. So that was one of the ideas. And I also want to thank the parents from Bransford Middle School for doing a really great teacher appreciation, staff appreciation lunch again today. And I know there's one of the moms. Friday for Harvard. Mm-hmm. So anyway, thank you to all the parents for honoring our hardworking staff. That's it.
I attended the Gala Getza festivities and had an amazing time, and it's just amazing. And I appreciate that event happens on our school campuses and involves a lot of our students and staff and the community. The community was out there represented in big numbers, so that was really pleasing to see. I also attended a coffee with the principal at Harbor and got to meet the new principal, and there were about 12 parents there, 8:30 in the morning. Had a wonderful conversation. The parents had a lot of good ideas to offer and good questions to ask. So that was a very enjoyable event as well.
That's it. I want to thank Molly and Human Resources, Daria in particular. It was a very nice retirement event, best I've been at. Very touching. Maybe it's just I'm getting older. Also want to thank both of the unions for participating and everyone who was there. We don't have that many rites of passage in this country, you know, mm-hmm. and it's, God knows I didn't go to my own retirement, mm-hmm. but it's an important moment, and I thought the words spoken about each and every retiree were really right on the money and very, very touching, mm-hmm. So I appreciate you being there. Thank you.
It is a busy time of the year, and so Nancy, with I will be submitting the majority of my report because I've been to a plethora of activities, but I did want to point one in particular out. On Friday the 20th, I had the opportunity to attend the Santa Cruz Rotary Scholarship Luncheon, and the motto of the Rotary is service above self. I was really very impressed with all the students, many from city schools who received scholarship, and one in particular, Ella Carroll. So I'd like to congratulate Ella on her academic scholarship and thank Nancy for taking my report.
I'm also going to submit my report, Nancy. Thank you.
Am I to understand this is your last time then, Ella?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to say that I have found you to be a delightful student on this board, intelligent, and I loved your sense of humor. So I really appreciated you being on the board, and I will miss you.
Thank you. It was really nice to be
here. Are you decided already where you're going?
I'll be at Cabrillo, actually, keeping it local.
All right. That's where my daughter went. Good place. I attended the Santa Cruz High School teacher luncheon, which was also the goodbye for Karen Edmonds at Santa Cruz High, the principal, and had a wonderful time. It was a great luncheon. She got the mayor special day, so she has a day from now on. I think it was May 18th, I'm not sure. So you can call her May 18th every year and remind her. The food was delicious, lots of the teachers showed up, and it was a really positive event. I have visited the Santa Cruz Parcel Tax Oversight Committee meeting and learned a lot about how that meeting runs. I attended the teachers' retirement celebration, and like Jeremy, I found it to be very touching. It's just amazing when people get up there and they have been with this district for 39 years and they give speeches in which they loved every minute. And the people who are presenting them tell stories about them that make you realize that these are people who have changed people's lives. And I'm talking about our certificated staff, our teachers, but also our staff. And we had two principals, of course, leaving this year, too. So it was a great event. And like Jeremy said, it was very well done in terms of what was said about the people were real things that people actually took some thought in presenting each one of the people who retired. I attended the Budget Advisory Committee meeting last night, and I will be attending the PTA at Westlake tomorrow. So this is like busy week. And that's it for me. Thank you.
So I was invited to be a judge for the Harbor ROP portfolio and had a wonderful morning looking at these beautiful ROP portfolios, mostly in the media arts strand. So impressed by the work that the students did, their articulation, the way that they spoke about their work, their plans for what they were going to do as their next step. And then I was invited to come to the countywide presentation of the awards by Sherry Williams. I want to thank her for all of her work in our ROP program. I attended the first meeting of the Santa Cruz City School LGBT Task Force. There was about 15 people, kind of a balance between school and district leadership and community partners, and really had a lively discussion about how to create and support students, LGBTQ students on our campuses, and a presentation by Ron Indra, the director of the Safe Schools Project, on current legislation, the mounting legislation around LGBTQ rights. And it was an excellent first meeting. You know, it's a good first meeting when people want homework over the summer, and I had to say, let's wait until the new school year. Let's mostly to protect our teachers who need a break during the summer. And then I was delighted to be at the labor management. I thought it was a collaborative meeting. I had such a great conversation with everyone, and the last thing was the Gala Getza, fabulous event. And I also want to thank Nereida Robles and Faye Silva for their work, and Senderos, all the people in Senderos, and the dozens of Santa Cruz City School administrators and teachers who on their Sunday were out in the hot sun at tables and working the event, volunteering at the event. So it was really, truly a community event, and it was fabulous. I loved it. And I just want to thank you, Ella, for being here, for your sharp mind. You have a knack for policy. I would not be surprised to see your name sometime in the future. Maybe a president, not the first maybe, but maybe a president of the United States. I wouldn't be surprised. So thank you for everything that you put in. It was really, truly appreciated.
Thank you.
And it is time for approval of the minutes. Minutes of the regular meeting on May 11, 2016. Do you have a motion?
Move approval.
Second.
Sheila and Didi.
Thank you.
Student recommendation?
Abstain.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain.
7-0.
Thank you.
And minutes of the Finance Authority meeting on May 11th, 2016.
Move approval.
Student recommendation?
Abstain.
I'm sorry,
move approval.
Oh, wait. Move
second.
Approval.
Second.
Second. Student recommendation?
Abstain.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain.
7-0. Thank you so much.
Okay, the next item is the consent agenda. The consent agenda is for non-controversial items that can be passed in one roll call vote. Are there any items on the consent agenda that the board would like removed for discussion?
Madam President, just a reminder that item 8.1.10.4.1 has been removed.
10.4.1.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. Are there members of the public who would like to speak to any of the items on the consent agenda? Or any board questions? Okay. We have a motion.
I'll move approval.
Second.
Student recommendation?
Aye.
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 Aye. Claudia will report on actions taken in closed session.
The Board of Trustees took action on certificated, classified, and management leaves, retirements, resignations, and appointments. The Board of Trustees heard an update and provided Assistant Superintendent Molly Parks with direction regarding CSCFT negotiations. The Board of Trustees heard information on expulsion 14, 15, 16. The Board of Trustees heard information regarding a public employee performance evaluation.
Thank you, Claudia.
Are you going to say anything?
Sheila will report on the gifts.
No, we don't have any gifts.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I thought that's what you were telling me. Okay, we need to vote on expulsion 14, 15, 16. Is there a motion to adopt the recommended decision for student 14, 15, 16?
I move to expel student 14, 15, 16 through the end of the 2016 summer session and suspend the enforcement of the expulsion to allow student 14, 15, 16 to remain concurrently enrolled at a district school on a strict behavior contract through the end of the 2016 summer session.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstain.
Thank you.
Okay, item 8.3.1, True North polling results.
Thank you, President Thompson. It's a pleasure tonight that we reintroduced to the Santa Cruz City Schools public Dr. Timothy McCarney. Dr. Timothy McCarney comes from True North Research. He is the pollster that has been hired through the board-approved contract with Clifford Moss and will present information on the revenue measure feasibility study to the district.
Good evening, Trustee members of the board. Dr. Sim Carney, President of True North, and we are a firm that for the past 15 years has specialized in working with school districts around the state as well as other public agencies doing surveys to develop a statistically reliable understanding of the communities that they serve. Tonight's presentation covers the highlights of a survey we recently conducted for the district on the feasibility of a couple of bond measures that the district's considering. Just for a way of context, we've wound up over our careers working on about 900 research studies. About a third of those are revenue measure feasibility studies. We've helped raise about $24 billion in voter-approved measures throughout the state, and we've been able to maintain the 92% success rate for measures that would recommend go to ballot since the start of the recession. And I mention that because as I go through tonight's presentation, or perhaps in response to questions from the board, I may make reference to how the results we're seeing here in Santa Cruz compared to what we might typically see. And I wanted you to have a sense for the experience for which I'm going to be commenting. Your results are exceptional, and so we'll get into that in a second. I also welcome questions as I go or at the end, whichever is your preference. Okay. Before we talk about the results, helpful to take a moment to review the purpose. No, it's not. Is that better? Is it? All right. Well, I was hearing myself great.
We always do.
All right. So before we talk about the results, helpful to take a moment to review the purpose of the study or the why we do this, as well as the methodology of how we go about doing these types of studies. In terms of the purpose, we're trying to answer three overarching or address three overarching topics when we're doing these types of studies. The first is to answer this question of feasibility. If the board were to choose to place one or more bond measures on the November ballot, is it feasible? And what I mean when I say is it feasible is, does that bond or bonds have a reasonable chance of being successful on election day? Answer to that question is not always yes. Sometimes I do this type of work, and when I stand up and give these presentations, my recommendation is you're really not ready. You're not in a position where you can get from where you are today to where you need to be successful on election day, and if that's the case, I'm very frank about that. That isn't the case tonight, as we'll see, but when that isn't the case, when it is feasible to move forward, the other overarching objective we're trying to answer is, well, then how do you go about structuring these bonds in a way that they're consistent with the type of measure that your community is interested in supporting? There's a lot of components to a bond, right? There's the project list, so what are you going to actually do with the money if it's successful in terms of buildings and facilities on your campuses? There's also the question of the price tag, right? How much does the bond amount be overall? What's the underlying tax rate that's associated with that? What sort of accountabilities are built into the measure, et cetera. So all of these things are topics that the survey can help guide those types of decisions in terms of how you go about structuring your bond measures. And then finally, it's an opportunity to gather information that's helpful for communications and outreach. Right? It's important that if you're going to take the step of placing these measures on the ballot and asking voters to make a decision about these bonds, that you actually help inform them and educate them about the choice you're asking them to make. Right? So it's important that we communicate about what the needs are and what these measures would accomplish so that voters are well-informed when they go in and vote yes or no on those measures. All right. In terms of methodology, survey was conducted in May of this year. We spoke with 405 voters who are what we call likely November 2016 voters. These are voters that we would expect to actually cast a ballot on the natural in this November election. We use what's called a random, stratified and clustered random sample. I can get into the details of that if you want, but suffice it to say that at the end of that process, we have a sample that's in fact representative of your likely November voter universe on all the characteristics that we know are related to voting behavior, things like age and gender, partisanship, household party type, all of those things that sort of shape how people behave when it comes to revenue measures. Our sample is in fact representative of your likely November universe. Now, you're a unique district in that you have two districts nested within, well, one district nested within another. So you have a larger high school district, and within that you have an elementary school district that represents a portion of the district. We structured our sample so that you could have, we could look at a representative sample of those who were at high school district overall, but also to be able to subset and look just at your elementary school district. And the reason we did that is because in terms of the bonds, you're actually looking at two bond measures, right? One that would be for the high school district, the entire thing. And if you're also within the elementary school district, there would be a second bond that would focus just on the elementary school district. So the survey was designed to deal with that scenario, similar to what we did with the partial text survey. And as you'll see, we'll be commenting about two different measures as we move forward in these results. Measure A is just the elementary school district. Measure B would be for the high schools, and that would be the entire high school district. We use what's called a mixed method approach, meaning that we use multiple recruiting methods. We recruited by telephone and email. We also use multiple data collection methods, telephone as well as online and a secure password-protected website that we host. And now because these were random samples of your likely voters and not a census of all of your November 2016 voters, the survey has a margin of error due to sampling. For the high school district overall, which got all 405 interviews, the margin of error is plus or minus 4.8%. For the elementary school district, which represents a subset of that total sample, the margin of error is plus or minus about 6.5%. Yes.
Two questions. One is, could you explain why there would be that difference? And the other is, did you take into, or how can one take into consideration that this is going to be an unusual election in terms of who's voting?
Sure. Well, the first thing in terms of the margin of error, there's four factors that go into determining the margin of error for a poll like this, one of which is your sample size, right? So for the high school district, because you're the total, you know, your high school district encompasses your entire boundaries, all of the voters. When we pulled our random sample of 405 voters, they were all within your high school district, right? So your sample size was 405. The margin of error, the maximum margin of error due to sampling in that scenario is the plus or minus 4.85%. The elementary school district is a smaller portion, right? It doesn't include your entire high school district, and therefore, some of the voters who are in your high school district that aren't in your elementary school district have to be filtered out when we're analyzing the results at the elementary school district level. And so for those results that are just within the elementary school district, the margin of error is going to be a little higher because the sample size is a little low, right? And that's how we wind up with the plus or minus 6.4%. In terms of it being an unusual and an exceptional election environment, I could spend an hour talking about how you wind up dealing with that in these studies. I can tell you that one of the big things we look at is turnout, right, naturally, and we can go back and look at the voting behavior of your voters on past elections to understand, is this somebody we expect to actually cast a ballot in this upcoming election or not, right? We also have the ability to do sensitivity testing on that so we can tweak it. We expect a little more Republican turnout this time because of Trump, or a little less because he doesn't have a lot of the Republicans with him, right? If if this was a June election, people have been remodeling that turnout a lot because everybody expected, right, that it would be a slugfest in the Republican Party and that contest would still be open, but that Hillary would have sewn up. Well, instead, we have the opposite, right? We still have the Democrats battling it out for that nomination, and Trump has it sewn up on the Republican side, and people theorize what that's going to do to turnout, right, in terms of how many Republicans are turn out, how many Democrats are going to turn out. So we can do the same thing on the November election here, and we do, and we look at that. I think when you get to the results, you realize, you know, when we do all of this, they sway 1 or 2 points, which in your case doesn't matter at all, right, because your results are so positive.
So that's all it would take away is like 1 or 2 points making those adjustments?
Yeah. In your community, because on a turnout profile, it does not ultimately shape the results that much because they are so overwhelmingly one way.
Okay.
On to the results. So this first slide shows what's called the importance of issues slide. And for each of the issues you see there up on the left side of that slide, we simply ask people to tell us how important is this to you. Is it extremely important or very important, which are represented by the dark blue and medium blue bars? Is it somewhat important or not all important, which is represented by that negative space off to the right? We ask these items in a random order, but we sorted them here from high to low based on that combined percentage of folks who said it was either extremely or very important. This is our first question in the survey, and we ask it both to warm people up, get them thinking about local issues, but it's also an opportunity for us to understand how things that might be addressed by your bond, right, stack up against these other issues that also compete for tax dollars, as well as this issue of preventing local tax increases. So one of the relationships we pay a lot of attention to is what's the importance that voters assign to improving the quality of education in local schools versus the issue of preventing local tax increases. And as you can see on this slide, improving the quality of education in local schools had 81% of your voters say that's extremely or very important. And if you look at preventing local tax increases, it's 31, right? So there's a 50-point gap in the importance between those two items. That is large, right? In most districts that we work with, the typical gap's about 25 points. So it's double that here in your community. That's generally a very good thing when you think about potential bond or tax measures for education. Kind of makes sense that if they care a lot more about education relative to preventing local tax increases, it tends to bode well for them supporting some type of tax measure. The other thing we pay attention to is that issue of repairing and upgrading aging school facilities, which kind of comes in the middle there. It has 70% extremely very important. That's lower than the issue of improving the quality of education. That's always the case. And it's kind of a nice, useful reminder to us that at the end of the day, voters don't care so much about buildings and facilities as much as they do care about what those buildings and facility improvements are going to enable in terms of a quality education, right? So it's important to be connecting the dots when you're talking about your bond, about what you're going to build, but also why it matters, right? What's it going to do in terms of education? That said, we still have a gap of almost 40 points between the issue of repairing and upgrading aging school facilities versus preventing local tax increases. That may be the largest gap I've ever seen between those two items. If I knew nothing else about the results, and I didn't know I was in Santa Cruz, although I probably would because protecting the environment never comes in. I would look at these results and say, we're going to have feasibility, right? Because this is a textbook example of if you can script it how you'd like to see this, the answers to this question, this is what you'd see. Now, from here, we go right to what we call our initial ballot test. And the idea is, before we get any deeper into the interview and start talking about the district's facility needs, and what types of projects you'd be funding, the types of tax rates that could be associated with these bonds, arguments pro and con, we want to present to them a mock-up of what we think the 75-word ballot statement would look like and get their reaction. It's a really good gauge of where your community is at on the national with respect to the proposals you're considering. And so we have two measures we're going to be talking about. Measure A is for the elementary school district. Measure B is for the high school district. So here's the language for Measure A, and you'll note that it's a $65 million bond to improve your elementary school districts. Measure B reads a little differently, and the main difference is this is for your high schools and middle schools, and this is for $135 million. So that we read them these statements, and then we ask them how they would vote on them. here are the results. Measure A checked in with 78% support at that initial ballot test. Measure B checked in with 75% support at that initial ballot test. In the state of California, for a Prop 39 bond, you need 55%. This is not two-thirds like it is for your parcel taxes. And so right out of the gates, we have 23 points above that 55% margin for Measure A, and we have 20 points above that 55% margin for Measure B. Exceptionally strong results, and the fact that you have two measures on the same ballot and you're still having Measure B check in at 75% is just it's unheard of, basically, in terms of the work that we do. So you have to understand that on the spectrum of strong results, this is a real far outlier.
Really, really strong.
So now, after the initial ballot test, we get to what we call our tax threshold questions. And you know, one of the unique things about bond ballot language, that 75-word statement I read you earlier, is it doesn't make the price tag clear, right? Mm-hmm. $65 million sounds like a lot of money, but I don't know what that means to me as a property owner, right, or somebody who's going to rent to a property owner. And naturally, support for a measure can depend on what that price tag is. And so we want to make clear in the space of the survey that bonds mean taxes, right? And we also want to test at different possible tax implications to the household or ways of conveying that, how support for your respective measures may depend on what that price tag is. And so for Measure A, we go about this first by explaining that you know, the amount that if Measure A passes, if you heard that the property taxes on your house would increase by $30 per $100,000 assessed valuation, would you vote yes or no? And then we also test a somewhat lower amount at $24 per $100,000 assessed valuation. And what you see is when you convey it that way, at $30, you have two-thirds support, 67%. At $24, you have 72% support. This is a hard test on somebody's willingness to support your measure, because when you think about the nature of the question, it's forget about all the good things we're going to build and why it's needed. Let's talk about the money, right? Let's talk about the price tag. I'm going to put the blinders on you and focus you on that. And for that reason, when we do this type of research with other districts, what I'm looking for is a tax rate that has 55% or higher, right? And I'm comfortable at 55, because I know what that tells me is if they forget about everything else and it's the conversation becomes about the money, we still have our 55%. Here, at the highest that we can go at a $30 per $100,000 assessed valuation tax rate, you've got 67. So you've got a comfortable margin above that. Similar question, but for Measure B now, right? And for Measure B, $30, we have 64% support. At $24, we have 68% support. So a little softer, but it's also the second measure we're talking about for most voters, right? So we've already talked about Measure A, now we're going to talk about Measure B. And but still well above that 55% threshold that I mentioned that we were really looking at. Now, one of the things we've learned over time by doing this research is not everybody knows what assessed valuation means, right? People have a tendency to, when they think about what the assessed valuation is for their property, they tend to overestimate it, right? And think about market value instead of assessed value. And the nature of the question requires that people do math in their head on the fly in the space of an interview, and not all of us are good at that, understandably. And so when we say $30 per $100,000 assessed valuation, it leaves a little uncertainty for some voters, right? What exactly are we talking about at on my bottom line? And when a voter's uncertain, they tend to hedge, right? They tend to vote no instead of yes. And so the other way we test the tax implications is to say, let me put it another way. If both Measure A and Measure B pass, it would cost the typical homeowner about $225 per year, right? So we do the math for them. We take the median AV for a residential property in the district. We multiply it times that $30 tax rate. We do that for both Measure A and Measure B, and it checks in at about $225 a year for the typical property owner in the district. And so when you convey it that way, here's the results. You're back up over 70% for support for Measure A as well as Measure B. Note that for that slice of people that are only in the high school district but not in the elementary school district, we just gave them the annualized total for Measure B, and that would be $113. And so, but the point being is when you do the math for folks and you help them understand what the bottom line tax implication is of these measures, they're very comfortable with the dollar figure and the price tag for bonds together. All right, now, at this point, we transition to what we call our project session. The idea here is now we're going to, one, start to educate the respondent a little more about the proposal, so they have a better idea of what this bond will accomplish in terms of the project at your schools. And the second purpose is to help us understand, of all the things you're thinking about funding with these bond measures, which of these are your voters' priorities, right? Which of these rise to the top of the list in terms of favorability? And are there any anchors? And is there anything in your bond project list that you're considering that's unpopular, right? And you may want to rethink putting it in that list. And so the first takeaway from this slide is that there are no anchors, right? There isn't a single project that you're considering here that has less than 70% of voters say that they would favor spending some of the bond money on those items. At the top of the list, though, there are a couple of things that stand out as being the priorities, kind of the top four there. The first is what's basic repairs. So repairing and replacing leaky roofs, rusty plumbing, faulty electrical systems where needed, followed by providing classrooms and labs for career technical education courses. Okay. Third being removing hazardous materials like asbestos and lead paint from older school sites. And then the fourth is providing the facilities, equipment, and technology infrastructure needed to support high-quality instruction in reading, math, science, engineering, and technology, so sort of STEM plus reading. That list at the top that I just mentioned, is one way you are typical, right? That list of, when we do this kind of work in other districts, those four items I just read, you tend to be at the top of the list in other communities as well. Now, if the board chooses to place a measure on that November ballot, there is going to be an election cycle, as you know. And during that election cycle, there's going to be a lot of discussion and debate in the community about your proposals, right? You're going to have some individuals who are gung-ho supporters of this. They're going to be advocates of these bonds. They're going to stand up and argue to their neighbors and convince them that this is a good idea to be supporting it. You may also have some opponents who will stand up and say nasty things about your bond and try and convince their neighbors to oppose it. For this to be a reliable gauge of the feasibility of your bond measures, we need to be able to simulate that type of discussion and debate that's got to happen during the election cycle, so we know not only where are they today, which we saw in that initial ballot test, but what happens after they're exposed to the type of discussion that they're gonna be exposed to over the next few months. And so we do that by first conveying positive arguments. And the nature of the question is, supporters of the measure say blank, to insert a positive argument. Do you think this is a very convincing, somewhat convincing, or not at all convincing reason to support the measure? And as you can see here, there's a lot of positive arguments that get traction. In fact, I think they all get two-thirds of folks say it's at least a somewhat convincing reason, and many of them have more than three-quarters of voters saying that about the arguments. At the top of the list, though, is the one that I call our wise investment argument. It says, even if you do not have school-aged children, supporting the school bonds is a wise investment. Good schools improve the quality of life in our community and protect the value of our homes. And the second one's a little bit of a history lesson, letting people know that, you know, all the schools were built more than 50 years ago and need to be modernized. It's time to make essential repairs and improvements so the schools can serve our community well for decades to come. So you've got a lot of positive arguments that get traction. We also test negative arguments. We test fewer negatives because that tends to be an accurate simulation of what happens during election cycle. Your advocacy group tends to be larger in number, better organized, better funded, have a louder voice. And so we test fewer negatives, but the negatives we test are designed to be hard-hitting negative arguments, right? We're not pulling any punches. And at the top of the list, we have one that says these measures are unfair to seniors and others on fixed incomes. There is no exemption for seniors. Unlike parcel taxes, where there is a senior exemption, that does not exist for bonds, right? The second one was the district's passed 4 parcel taxes in the past 4 years for local schools. Now they want more money. That's not fair to taxpayers, right? So we're going for the throat with these negatives. We're not pulling any punches, but the real question is, what happens afterwards? And we pretty much land where we started. You have 78% support for Measure A, and you have 73% support for Measure B. Right, so your support is not only high, it's very resilient. It stays high. Bonnie and I have a number of districts that we're working with where this isn't the case. They start out okay, and things tend to fade real fast over the course of the interview. And so in this way, your results are, again, exceptional. All right, so a couple slides on conclusion. What does all this mean? The first slide here, I'm going to circle back to that overarching question I mentioned at the outset that motivates why you do this type of research, which is it feasible, right? If the board chooses to place these bonds on the November ballot, do they have a reasonable chance of success? I think the obvious answer to that is yes. All the things that we want to see in place for a measure to be feasible are in place here. We saw that voters perceive that improving the quality of education is among the two top issues facing the community. That translated into strong natural support for both measures, over 70%. The projects that you're talking about building are popular. The positive arguments resonated. And importantly, at each point where we checked in with them with the ballot statements and asked, now that you've heard a bit more, where do you stand? Your support levels were well above those 55% thresholds that need to be successful. And so, I would say that the answer to the question isn't yes, you have a reasonable chance of success. I would say it's yes, you have an exceptionally good chance of being successful on the November ballot. Now, having said that, I just want to remind everybody that a poll is not a crystal ball. Looking forward to Election Day saying you're going to get 78% on Election Day. It's a snapshot in time. What happens on Election Day isn't what your poll says today. What determines it is everything that happens from here forward, right? It's the decisions that the board makes with respect to how you structure these measures. It's the level of effort that goes into reaching out to your community and helping them understand these proposals. And so I mention that mainly because your results are exceptionally positive, and that sometimes makes me nervous because there's a tendency occasionally in some communities that when they see numbers like that, they kind of think we got it in the bag, and they get lazy, right? And they don't have those conversations with the community that they should. In politics as a nature, the natural tendency is for things to unravel if you're not holding them together. Right? And so very, very well positioned to be successful, but you still have to make smart decisions about how you structure these bonds, and you still have to put the work in to outreach and help inform your voters about what these measures are about. And so a couple thoughts just in terms of structuring. Tax rate, the Prop 30 max, Prop 39 max for your two bonds is $30 per $100,000 assessed valuation. Feel very comfortable that you could go out with those with a tax rate at that level, right? I don't see that. Your needs exceed what you're going to get from both of these bonds anyway, so there's no motivation to really ratchet that tax rate back. And so I would recommend going ahead and setting that tax rate at $30 for $100,000 assessed valuation for both measures. In terms of projects list, I think you had a long list of things in that list, and I think a lot of those can be in your project list. But there needs to be an emphasis on core repairs, right? Things like roofs and plumbing and electrical systems, as well as, for some of your older soil sites, if they have hazardous materials, right, you're going to want to remove those. And finally, an emphasis on career tech and STEM. So how do these facility improvements ultimately help you in those two areas? And so with that, I end my presentation. I welcome any questions if there are any.
Questions from the board? Sheila.
So I just want to hear you say this. my biggest concern was the measures going up in June and the major transportation measure going up in November, and that was going to affect, there's going to be a weariness effect in the community. So I guess, my one conclusion is, we are so strong that as long as we do our job, we won't dip. We might dip, but not that much. But I'm wondering if there's also information that you have from doing this for a long period of time about that that would make me feel even more.
I think if you had marginal results, right? And by marginal, I mean 58%, 60%, and we're looking around and you're thinking about other things that are going to be on the ballot, there's going to be some competition from a region-wide, those sorts of things, that starts to be things you think strongly about and wondering how much of a dent might we take if we're on the same ballot with something that creates competition, right? With support at 70%+ and how resilient it is across in the course of the interview, even in the face of opposition arguments, I don't worry about what else is on the ballot. What I The only thing I would worry about is making sure you do what you need to do in terms of communicating with your voters. I think if you do that, you're in a very good place to be successful.
Dee Dee?
I just have a question about your sampling. I may have missed it, and you said it, so I apologize if that's the case. The sample included 405 district voters. There was a split sample study. All of the 405 included voters in the high school.
Correct.
For the high school district.
Correct.
But a subset of the 405 represented the elementary.
Correct.
And what was the number?
The subset.
The subset for the elementary.
Yeah, and I'm searching that out. I'm going to, just based on the margin of error, right, based on the margin of error there, I think it's probably about 285. But I can give a specific number. I don't have it in front of me at the moment. But based on that margin of error, that's about where that would have landed in a weighted scenario, which is when you look at the, I tend to think of it as onion, right? You have the whole onion is your high school district, and then you peel a layer away, and what you're left with is the elementary school district. Those proportions are correct in our data. So we're not over-representing your elementary or under-representing your elementary school district voters when we're looking at that high school measure B.
Okay, thank you.
Are there comments from the public?
I have a question. Does the district, propose to replace all of the portables that we have on campus?
That's the process that we're doing right now with the Facility Steering Committee. There seems to be a majority of conversation with the Steering Committee that portables would be replaced with permanent buildings. That ultimately would come before the board for the ultimate decision. I would say our discussion, probably about 80-90%, because there's some that still have feasibility, some are leased out to other entities outside of the district, that, and some aren't even owned by us. That, right. So I would say probably we've talked about in the Facility Steering Committee about 80-90%.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
And the other question that I have, I feel hard to get my microphone.
That's fine.
Is that we announced the bond 18 years ago, and is that the counter or argument to, that might pop up?
So the question was, you passed a bond, you said 18 years ago, and is that a counter argument that might pop up?
Yes.
18, in our experience, that's ancient history in the voters' minds for the most part. We have had districts where we passed double bonds and came back 4 years later and passed two more bonds, right? So when you have that scenario, when those measures are close, it can be a counter argument. I don't see an 18-year-old bond being a counter argument. What we did test as a counter argument was the notion of that you've passed four parcel taxes in a shorter period of time, closer to now. And that negative argument got a little traction when you ask it, but then when you go back to the final ballot test, support levels are still in the 70s.
Thank you.
Yeah, just one comment that the more we make it about need and telling the story of need, which your needs far exceed what we're seeing as the affordable sweet spot, that's a candid, honest story to your community. It's a prudent story to say it's been 18 years since we passed our last bond. And here is the evidence of need. So that helps us.
Mm-hmm. More comments, questions from the public?
Casey Carlson from the Greater Santa Cruz Federation of Teachers, formerly the political organizer. And our political organizer, Matt Brunner, is at the Democratic Central Committee right now, building up that community support. But I do have a question, comment on something that he's brought up, just something to think about. When you look at the projects, all of them actually pull well, right, as I understand it. And the priorities, the one you just had.
Projects?
I was going to. Yeah. And then go back to the one you had.
There?
Yeah.
One more, right?
The one that you were just on before you moved.
Other art.
No.
The last
slide that you have. There you go. So where you have the conclusion No, that isn't the one we had.
One more.
Your conclusion, there you go, project list, has core repairs, removal of hazardous materials, career tech, and STEM, all are very important. And I would like the ceiling tiles to stop falling off my ceiling. But what I wanted to bring up, and Patty knows this from all of our walks, is that the athletic parents were extremely crucial to the passage of our high school and our students. And I see that the upgrade of athletic facilities, sports buildings, is not the highest, and yet when you look at it, it is still, when you combine strongly favored and somewhat favored, it's still very high. I think it's 73. It's hard for me to read the numbers, but I just, as the committee is forming, I would want that to be considered, because in terms of what you were talking about getting the community behind it, I know you were calling men and voters, but in terms of the active people who are going to walk and go door to door, we just had like weekend after weekend and night after night of the athletic teams, kids, parents, they were like our most active supporters, so I just want to make sure that that doesn't get forgotten.
Any other public comment? Okay, this isn't an action item, but were there any other comments from the board? Patty.
I just want to thank you, Dr. McLarney, and I'm hoping that you will continue to enjoy coming back to your area of alma mater, and I do enjoy that when you report out that you're amazed, but not truly amazed, but still happily amazed at how this community supports public education. And I'm quite thankful for it, and should the board choose to go forward, I'm prepared to work to make sure it happens. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to personally thank Dr. McLarney and Bonnie Moss from Clifford Moss, which is our political consultant that we've been using, and the board approves the contract. One of the things I think that we really stress as part of the poll in this process, again, not holding back the punches, knowing with some of the arguments that may arise during the next couple of months, we wanted to make sure to address those pieces. So I want to thank them both for the thoroughness and support of this information.
Excellent. Thank you both very much. Okay. I am opening the public hearing for our math adoptions for grades K-5.
Before we do open this up for public comment, I want to just point out this is the first adoption public hearing we've had since 2008. As part of the public hearing, I want to make note of the fact that per the Ed Code, materials, the math materials that we've been piloting, need to be available to the public. And so they've been available to the district office, and Jennifer Wild has brought them tonight. And there have been posted notices just to make sure that the members of our community are aware and have that opportunity to produce those materials. So the public hearing precedes the adoption report. So there'll be opportunities both now and then as part of the report to post questions and comments.
Are there members of the public who would like to comment on the math adoption? Okay, we will close the public hearing, and we'll move on to 8.3.3, the math adoption approval.
So this is, again, another opportunity for me to thank our Director of Curriculum and Assessment, Jennifer Wildman, for her role in bringing back the adoption process and truly involving our school community in both the pilot and the selection. I'm going to turn it over to her to share with you the background of that process, and then we are bringing this report to you with a recommendation for approval of the materials that have been selected.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for having us here to talk a little bit about our elementary math adoption and the pilot process that happened behind it. We're really happy to say that it was a process that went really well, and since it's been planned for so long, we've been waiting for the state to adopt materials. It was great to be able to complete an adoption process and with such high quality results, we think. So instructional materials adoption has a number of statements in the Ed Code, things that we need to do, things that we have to comply with, most importantly, that we have the responsibility to conduct an evaluation of materials in a way that allows us to adopt those materials to meet the needs of our students. So the state comes up with an adoption list. It gives us some recommendations. They've evaluated the programs thoroughly, and then we're able to go through that list and see which of those programs meet our needs. In our district, the textbook selection committee was made up of 14 teachers. They all asked to volunteer. We did not ask them. All of our elementary programs had a representative, including our small schools representative from Monarch and also a special education representative. We also made sure we had people from the TWI program, and so we had some bilingual representation as well. We started off the process a long time ago. About a year ago, we did a survey of district teachers to ask what they were looking for in a program and also what they were looking for in a process, to try to make sure that we met everybody's needs. In that survey was also the opportunity where the teachers were able to volunteer to pilot if they wanted to. We got 70 responses to the survey, which is great. We only have 100 elementary teachers, so that was a really good response. And also, the teachers in that were able to rate some things, some of the textbook criteria, so we knew what they were looking for, what were the most important things that they were looking for. But they also got a lot of chances to comment, and we used those comments when we met with the pilot teachers to say, what really are teachers looking for when they pick up a math book and they're ready to teach their class? Two of the highest rated areas on that teachers were really looking for. Number one was a conceptually based math program. They wanted a heavily conceptually based program, which we have not always had. And the other thing is they were really stressing that they wanted the opportunity to collaboratively plan around that program. They wanted to be able to get together and make plans once we received the program. So to do the pilot, we got these 14 teachers together and we trained them in the first program. They went out and talked for 5 weeks and then came back and were trained in the second program, went out and talked for 5 weeks and came back. Also samples, times are changing. It's so interesting to have an instructional materials review, which we do have, but all of these materials are available online. So you can actually go online and see most of what's in all of these programs. And we also did a traveling show of the materials to make sure that every site got to see what was available in the program. After a whole day, which I thought we were going to need, this excellent group of teachers about noon came to a really good conclusion, which was overwhelmingly positive for adopting Eureka Math. And I'll tell you my big secret, it was unanimous. It was unanimous. So it wasn't unanimous in the morning. We took a little poll in the morning to see how people were feeling, and it was not unanimous at that point. So through deliberating and talking and coming to consensus, the teachers agreed that they were ready to adopt Eureka Math. And I actually want to introduce Alice Latona from De La Viega Elementary School, who was the only one of our private teachers who could come and who was willing to come at this very busy time of year. And I'm so grateful that she's here so that she can give you just a little bit of the experience from her point of view.
Hi, good evening, everybody. So just from my perspective, I think it spoke volumes for the material itself that 14 teachers get together and can come to a decision on anything. Together to really support something, because we did come from all different schools, different grade levels, and really some of us really like a certain material or really want something a certain way because we've done it that way for a long time. But it really came down to the content of what was in this program. So Eureka Math, many of us knew a little bit about it because many of us were already online doing different bits of it because it is made by teachers. It was put together by teachers. It was built, it's a nonprofit. That's also another thing that we really liked about this program. And everything is basically available online. Teachers have loved the material so much that they've already translated it themselves in other districts. So, that speaks a lot, I think, for the program itself. There was some concerns about maybe not also just having certain materials that would come with the program, because it doesn't come with a lot of bells and whistles. So that was, I know, one of the things that as teachers we kind of expressed concern in making sure that SweetReef does partner with another company that provides materials. So there's certain materials, but overall, you know, if we had to pick for, you know, materials or content, we really went for content, and this was really what it covered a lot, and it covered it in depth, and we really, really liked it. And yeah, it was very unanimous. We kind of all came to the conclusion this is a great program. We really, really like it, and it works for children, you know, local guys, and it works for the ones as they're being introduced into the middle school system, which is what we're trying to do, is more of alignment with the middle school and the high school, which do much, it's all collaborative. So this lends itself to be able to be used in that sense too. So it was a nice experience to hear from the, I teach third grade, so it's kind of in the middle, hear from the lower grades and hear from the upper grade teachers also.
So the group of pilot teachers was just, I can't even tell you how great the days that we spent together were. It was very exciting, and they did not come to easy agreement. There was a good discussion about what this program would be, and my favorite comment from one of the teachers who sat down at the end to give his piece about what he thought was, you know, I thought it was my job to convince you guys to get this other program. I love it, and this program is better. So it was a really interesting process, and it was really fun, which is really unusual for a textbook adoption. So we had a good time. And finally, we took the recommendation of this group of pilot teachers, and not knowing how overwhelmingly positive it would be, we wanted to have our math advisory council take a look also at the recommendation and the program. This is a group that's met, we'll meet for the third time next week, of teachers and administrators, parents, we have a university staff member, and people from the community, and it's a great little group. And they had some really good recommendations for us, and that was, great, you got your materials, okay, stop talking about that now, and just start to focus on the things that come next. And I think that was a really good recommendation for us to look at really good professional development, to make sure that we include teachers and the ownership of how it's implemented and how we decide about when and where things happen, and that we keep attending to teacher math content knowledge, because the world of math has changed, and a lot of us, you know, went to school at a time when the math instruction was slightly different. So we're coming across some need for professional development amongst ourselves so that we can support those kids as they move on to middle school and high school. And we did have the materials available next door to me for a week for people to view. There's also a stack of materials back there if you'd like to look at it. But Eureka Map is greatminds.net on the internet, and all of the materials are available for free to view. And we've already started the process with elementary principals of planning some pretty cool, intensive professional development next year on a rotating schedule so that grade levels can get together and we can solve any issues that we have with pacing or do some PD. It is not an easy program to implement. It's going to be quite a challenge. It's very fast-paced. It's extremely rigorous. And I'm really excited about that. But it's going to take everybody. So I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Other questions from the board? Dee Dee.
You mentioned that there will be a need for materials to complement or supplement the curriculum. Can you give me a better sense of what it is that, what are the needs and how extensive are the needs and that kind of nature?
So I think, and this is actually a piece that I'm not really sure, as we go through the materials, there's a lot of things that we have as teachers, and we were just, that was, I think one of the part of the big discussion was, you know, like, well, we've got this, and I've got boxes of that, and I have lots of this. But these little tiny things that, you know, the particular things that are very particular to this math program, that, so it wasn't everything. So there were particular things to the math program that would be things that people would have wanted to get that go particularly with this math program. So that's one of the things that we are trying to figure out.
We actually are taking an inventory of the manipulatives. It's those little, you know, these cubes and little blocks and cards, and Eureka has a very unique set of lyrics that go with it, and it also has all the other things that sometimes we have. So the teachers did specifically ask in the survey and in the pilot, please don't bring us 20 boxes of manipulatives. But there are some unique things that they really do need to teach that they could make, but we don't want our teachers to spend time making things. We want them to spend time planning and teaching. And so we're planning on ordering those, and we're working on that right now, taking an inventory to make sure we're ready.
Sheila. One second. Go ahead, Dee Dee.
Given that this is a nonprofit company, that I assume those materials that they provide would be pretty reasonably priced.
They are, and it's actually it's the most interesting group. The materials are invented or developed, I'm sorry, by the teachers. The teachers develop them. They do the professional development. They actually teach them every year. It's revised all the time. The program gets revised. All of the things you buy come from a for-profit publisher or a company that they work with to put together manipulative kits. So we're not buying from a nonprofit.
Sheila.
Oh, before I ask my question, I just want you to give that net thing again, the address.
Yeah. It's greatminds.net.
Greatminds. Okay. So I was just curious. I really liked the process you did. When you said it's very, very challenging. Very challenging. So I always get a little nervous about that because sometimes that translates into oblique, difficult to reach, or very verbal for nonverbal kids. And I'm wondering if you could explain what makes you say it's very challenging so that I understand that.
I can tell you what I know. So the program that we have right now is a publisher program. We've had it for a long time. So the other one that we were looking at was just an upgraded version of the program that we had. This is a whole new way of teaching math. It's paced differently. It's got, in fact, when the trainer came, she said, there are ways to take each one of these lessons and teach them for 5 days. It would easily happen. So we are going to have to be very smart about how we pace the program and what parts of it that we use and don't use, and that's where I think all our planning time comes in. The risk-taking part of this, we went to Galt today, and an example, they were asking lots of questions. They said, well, what about combo teachers? You have to forgive us while we're trying to put together this program. And I'm like, we're forgiving everyone while we try to put together this program. You'll forgive me, I forgive you, because there are so many things that we're going to have to learn together. So when we do an assessment and when we try to pace and when we're going to be making mistakes all over the place. And so is it challenging? Yeah, it's challenging. It's dense. There's a lot of material. It paced very quickly, but we're going to be putting it together in a way that works for us and for our students.
Jeremy.
As we move into a more collaborative way of teaching and doing math, my concern is that students who want to work independently and quietly by themselves still have a place at the table. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
I think the concern for the, it's definitely a concern. I, for myself, have noticed that it lends itself to those who, as a teacher, you're always trying to reach those kids who do want to go ahead and do, and having other things that I can supplement, the games or the things that those kids, if they're all done and they finish what they're doing, it can lend itself to the collaborative. Some of the teachers, the lessons themselves aren't designed as collaborative lessons, but you can use them that way, so the kids are introduced to it before they get into middle school, because that's the first time many of them ever start to work collaboratively in math. So some teachers said they tried it and it worked and they could do that, and others said, no, this lesson this unit didn't really lend itself to that, so I didn't do it there. But there's always room for those kids who want to work independently, but I think that considering, I think, as a teacher, you always take that personality of kid and you try and prepare them for what's going to come ahead. And part of that is the workplace is collaborative, most of what we do. So it's trying to find where that student can work at his best or her best.
Are there comments from the public? Any last comments from the board? Okay, this is an thank you so much for such a thorough process.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Excellent. This is a action item, and the recommendation is to approve the materials. Do we have a motion?
I move we approve the materials.
I'll second.
I'm sorry, the second was?
Sorry. Student recommendation? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstained? And 8.3.4, the Green Schools Committee Annual Report.
Thank you, President Thompson. Bringing forward tonight is the Annual Report of the Green Schools Committee. And we continue to meet as a functioning committee. I want to thank Member Shelton, who is our board representative to the Green Schools Committee on behalf of Santa Cruz City Schools, Mr. Miller, who's been my right hand at all the meetings throughout the year. And we met, I'm not going to go through all of the report word by word, but we continue to meet as a district or as a Green Schools Committee within the district. One of the changes that occurred last year was it became a superintendent committee, which allowed us the flexibility to continue to meet based upon that piece and being able the flexibility to meet the needs as a Green School Committee. So I wanted to start out by showing some of our individuals that have met this year and what they brought to the table. Started with Ms. Molly Bain from the Coastal Watershed Commission. We had some individuals from Global Student Embassy, which created a new partnership with the district this year, which is having a tremendous positive effect, I think, a lot of our high schools, mm-hmm. with the gardens that are being grown there and some student experiences abroad and bringing students from other countries to Santa Cruz City Schools. Julia Davenport, who created some of that watershed curriculum when she was working real closely with Santa Cruz City Schools, has now become an employee of the city of Santa Cruz and has been one of our biggest advocates. And we also want to thank the city themselves who paid for the transportation for our students to attend the watershed curriculum. We maintain the partnerships, as you mentioned, with the city of Santa Cruz, with the waste management area, University of California Santa Cruz Sustainability, which is working closely with Mr. Miller on the DROPS program that we're continuing to implement, besides some obstacles we're seeing from the state with the grant itself. We continue to work through that piece. And not going through line by line, but you see we just have a tremendous amount of partnerships with this committee. One of our newest members, I noticed in the audience tonight, Mr. Roland Sayer, who brought some information towards the latter part of the year with the Climate Change Speakers Bureau. That will be an initiative that I pass on to my successor to work closely with the new Ed Services piece of how to begin to incorporate that piece of information within our educational structure. So that's something that you brought probably our second to last meeting, and so we're going through that process now with the new individuals that believe in that cause to really see how we can formulate that as it affects the curriculum within the city schools. We maintain a partnership with the Museum of Natural History, community members, again, that's been really, really critical. A big thank you to Catherine Meyer-Johnson, who happens to be there taking a lot of the minutes and notes for us, which is a lengthy process, but gets everything down and really helps us to maintain the minutiae that we can then present to you. And of course, our classified and teaching staff that were well represented throughout, have come with some wonderful ideas on how we continue to positively affect our students in this Green Schools piece throughout. And again, of course, thank you to Mr. Schoenig as the board member. What are some of the highlights? We've continued development of the DROPS grant. It's taken a little bit of a slower process, again, because of some of the information we're working with the state and some of the onerous requirements. Trevor's been working diligently with the reps to see what we can do to facilitate and expedite that process. A true Green Apple Day of Service, which is continuous at Bayview School, and they can do that on an annual basis. It was very successful again this year. Again, we talk about the watershed curriculum, the resource recovery facilities and partnerships with the city and the counties and those necessary entities there. We continue to co-host the Ecology Action Bike Days, which I think are really critical. As you know, the transportation remaining green in that component within the city and county of Santa Cruz. And again, a true highlight we really felt was this new partnership with Global Student Embassy. They're really reaching out to our students, especially at the secondary level, creating some opportunities with the gardens at each of our sites and expanding just that piece within, you know, our curriculum within the district itself. a recent piece that we're really excited about, which will be a presentation we're going to kind of hold off on, that'll be later in tonight's meeting, is the selection of climate tech as using some of the Prop 39 clean energy dollars that we're bringing forward to you that are specified for these uses that do create savings and continue us as a great partner within these projects. Again, we continue to address the water conservation. Thanks to direction from the board, we continue to make progress on that and trying to minimize our footprint in that area. We looked at the renovation of the athletic field at Soquel High, and I can tell you that today we closed the actual financing on the Santa Cruz High School field. So that piece will begin as we continue the RFP process, and so that'll be a very ambitious project for Mr. Miller and his team over the summer months. And we continue to work with the Monterey Bay Unified Air Pollution Control District to really continue to be good partners with the replacement of buses and emissions control. What are some future opportunities we feel with this committee? Well, and we really want to try, with my successor, revive that student subcommittee, because that's the future, and really get in that engagement there. We want to continue the partnerships, and they are very strong, with the city, the county, the museums, Ecology Action, to really maintain that partnership and to show we're just really strong partners in the area. We want to review the opportunity to address the climate change and the awareness, how that impacts us in the future. That is definitely one of our places we want to do and bring forward with the new Ed Services side of the house. And again, we really felt it's been beneficial in the flexibility of the group as a superintendent committee. I think it was very solid direction that the board gave last year because it allowed us to continue to meet on a quarterly basis. Sometimes we had 10, sometimes we had 12. I think we had as high as maybe 16 at a couple of meetings. A couple of those would not have made the quorum under the old way that the committee met. So I think this allowed us to continue to make our mark and the imprint with the green schools. So with that, I very happily submit the annual report to the board.
Thank you so much. Do we have questions from the board? Okay, are there members of the public that would like to speak? Okay, 1 second. Go ahead, Ella.
Okay, I have a question about the student subcommittee. I wanted to get a better idea of what you meant by that and like how you would recruit. I have the impression
we actually sent emails. My administrative assistant did to all the site principals to engage because we had the members that were on the committee for 3 to 4 years. And the board member, Jeremy Schoenig, and I and Trevor would meet at least half an hour before every meeting just to get student engagement and questions answered of what direction we would go, how we continue the involvement. So somehow we just need to really revive that piece to see what we really do to recruit some students that are really actively involved in this process so we can directly hear from the students as part of the Green Schools Committee.
So it's going to be like a campus-by-campus outreach?
Kind correct. Of okay. Correct.
Okay, public comment.
My name is Roland Sayer, and I'm here with a group of residents of Santa Cruz County, City and County, who have set themselves the goal to make every student in the district become climate change literate. And we appreciate everything that the board, and particularly the teachers, and other people in the district are doing, have done already towards that goal, but we want to make it so that every student is climate change literate. And we're asking for your support towards that goal. So there were actually more speakers that are lined up here, but some of them have finals tomorrow, they have all the for that. Some of them have just regular homework they had to leave because of that, and other people I don't know that also left. So, please.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and thank you for everything you are doing.
Can you use the microphone?
My name is Pauline Seals, I'm a retired teacher of physics and environmental science. I'm a retired teacher of physics and environmental science. I'm working with Roland on various climate education issues. It's a difficult topic. It's difficult for the public to grasp, and we are working at this very hard. I wanted to show you something we used at the Earth Day. So This map shows various areas of Santa Cruz quite dark. Now, these lower areas. So the areas that are the darkest colors are the beach flats and Neary. And the experts, Ross Clark and Gary Briggs, have said it will only be a matter of 15, 20 years or so before these are being flooded on a regular basis at high tides. Now, how long it will take before the downtown area is flooded, we don't exactly know. But it's certain that it will be. Now, maybe that's 500 years, but maybe it's not, because all the new data says that everything's getting much hotter, the ice in the Antarctic and Greenland is melting way faster than anybody expected. And so it's a serious problem. The students of today especially need to be as equipped as possible to deal with this in their lifetime. And students are also an excellent way of communicating with the general public. They talk to their parents. Their parents are too busy to go to meetings and this and that. But the students talk to their parents. And so this can be a very helpful way to educate the public, because we need the public educated. We're not trying to pull anything over anybody, the exact opposite, but they do need to understand the situation. Thank you for everything you're doing and for the opportunity to speak.
Hi, my name is Kirti Gregorian. I'm 18 years old, and I didn't go to high school in this school district, but I went to a public high school that didn't inform me about the way climate affects our health, or that the climate is indeed changing. Going into my first semester of college, I didn't have, there wasn't any mandatory science credit, but I was interested in the science, and one of the choices was a planetary climate science class, and I chose it just out of the random interest I had at the moment, and what I learned from that class was really, really important about how climate is affecting our health and our communities, and also it indeed is changing. And so my conclusion from this is that it should not be a random choice. It should not be a random selection for for a kid to choose climate change education. It should be a mandatory requisite to understand the effects on human health. And I also received a lot of information to inform my friends and my family of this issue, how I could use my own resources, like water, for instance, to use it in a responsible way. It also affected where I want to go for my future career. So it had a major impact on my direction in my life. And so I really, really think that it's an important information to get across. It also, taking that class also connected me with a Sustainability Council Club, whose focus is to provide education and opportunities through local initiatives and conferences. That's about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, good evening. My name is Maria Perez. I'm a student at Pajo Valley High School. I'm an 11th grader, and I also attend Cabrillo. I also took the Planetary Climate Science. And even though my high school is an environmental school, not all the students know about it. Not all the students know about global warming. And I think that should be something really important that students should understand. And that's why I attend to my community college, because I want to stay informed about what's going on in my environment. I was born in Mexico, and over there I never heard about global warming. And I think it's because of the lack of resources in Mexico. And we are in the United States, and we have the resources to to teach the students about the importance of this problem, and I think something should go about, should be done about it, and thank you.
Hi, my name is Jessica Guccioni. I teach science at Shoreline Middle School in Live Oak, and for the last 3 years I've been working on bringing climate change into my classroom. And my inspiration started during my time at Harvard, and part of my requirements for getting my master's was to take a graduate level science class. And so I enrolled in this science class with a bunch of other PhD students who were all knew a lot more about this than I did. And the goal of the class, our final project was to solve the climate crisis and to actually sit down with the numbers and sit down with our society, given the way that we are and the interests that different industries have, and to come up with a solution. And it was a really difficult problem, and it was a really wonderful experience. And so I took it back to my eighth graders, and I scaffolded the entire thing, and we do it in eighth grade now. And so my eighth graders go through this process of solving the climate change crisis, and it's just a beautiful thing to see as a teacher. And they follow a model that was originally published by some Princeton researchers, and they do it closely, and they're doing graphing, and it's cross-curriculum, and it's just wonderful. And they researched 15 different things that we have the current technology to do that could help solve the climate crisis. Things like nuclear energy, just driving less, all sorts of different things. And they go and they learn about them from a science perspective, but from a societal perspective as well. And to talk about, you know, are they going to be okay with all of us driving less? And what sort of challenges are they going to put up? And we have these real life debates that they're going to, when they're citizens in our communities, they're going to be having these same debates. Like, and so we have this in our classrooms, and the project culminates with in the invitation of community members who do this for their living, coming into our classrooms and seeing this wonderful opportunity to come into our schools and see what we're doing in our classrooms and hear our students, especially as a middle school teacher, to see them having these blossoming opinions for some of the first time and to share them with communities. And then they have it back and forth, and it's a wonderful, wonderful thing for me as a teacher to be able to send my students out into the world with some basic understanding of some intersections of science and society, especially here in Santa Cruz, and to know that when they go out to the world, they are going to form their own opinions, they're going to be educated, and I think this is an absolutely wonderful opportunity for the students, so thank you.
Thank you.
Hi there, my name is Aaron Lemus. I'm a full-time student at Cabrillo College, a bike mechanic at Cabrillo Bike Cooperative, president of the Cabrillo Sustainability Council, and a substitute teacher's aide for Santa Cruz County of Education, special needs and emotional needs K-12 classrooms. Throughout my childhood, I learned more and more about climate change and its greedy causes and disastrous effects. While learning, I took responsibility to teach what I learned to all who wanted to listen, since it is vital to the future of this planet and all beings who live on it. Unfortunately, it was not mandatory to learn about climate change in my elementary or high school, and even at Cabrillo College. I'm happy to hear of the progress already made towards climate change literacy within SCCOE schools. As a supporter of the sustainable transportation and a co-educator on Cabrillo's campus, it is so important for climate change literacy and sustainable alternatives to be incorporated in all children's schools' curriculum. Not only book smarts is needed, though. We need to ensure that we are giving them daily opportunities to connect with nature so that children learn how to connect with themselves, connect with others, and learn to appreciate this earth as a gift that is given to us, and that it is our responsibility to nurture this gift. It is their right to know what's going on, the real causes and effects, and who is responsible. I am calling on you to help protect our children's future and their right. And who? I am calling on you to help protect our children's right to experience this gift as well, and protect this earth through further climate change education for future generations to come. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you for letting us speak tonight. My name is Robert Morgan, And I'm an English teacher, high school English teacher. I taught at Santa Cruz High School for 3 years. Then I became an elementary principal. And my son was here tonight. He's an eighth grader at Tierra Pacifica, and he will be going to Santa Cruz High next year. They do a wonderful unit in climate change at Tierra Pacifica in the eighth grade, and he's given a presentation to his classmates because I took my whole family to Miami to see Al Gore and to be trained in Climate Reality Project training that they do throughout the United States and the world. We think it's a very important subject. We give a lot of time to it. I currently give guest lectures in Pomerol, and I will soon be here also, to integrated study students, students who are in 9th and 10th grades, study all about earth science. And I've done about 10 or 12 different lectures to these students. There is a need, there is a desire, there is an interest. So I urge you to investigate climate change as a strong curriculum subject in the sciences in the Santa Cruz City Schools. Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Can I just
wrap up?
So thank you for your...
Thank you for your time. And I just want to point out I'm really grateful to the Green Schools Committee that they had us there, and we want to continue collaborating with them. We also talked with Heather Murphy, and she has made contacts with various science teachers across the district, and there was quite a bit of interest. But we have this very high goal for ourselves and for the district to have every student become climate change literate. And we ask you to help us with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is Robert.
Yeah. Good evening. I'm going to give you a little reality check here on Green. I work at SoCal High, as it used to be known. And so a little bit of a scientific survey piece. So from 7:07 in the morning to 8:47 in the morning, 419 cars come into SoCal High School and leave SoCal High School. They drop off one student. The majority of them are dropping off one student. So if we're going to really take effort at making some change in the environment, we should need to do what they did in 1966 at SoCal High School, and that was have bus routes. Bus routes. So if we had 5 buses, that would eliminate 419 cars. So a matter of putting some bus routes in and providing some kind of alternative transportation other than a single car dropping off a student at school, which is not green, needs to be implemented. Now they say, oh, there's no money. But is there money, or is there no money? Because when Capitola starts to disappear, where is that property going to go? Where is the money? How much is that going to cost? Or is it going to be nice that SoCal High will be on the cliff and have a beachfront property? So we have to really take this seriously. We have to look at what we're doing, and we have to look at what we did. Not us, but what those who came before us did. And that is they had bus routes. The buses circulated, and you had, instead of 419 cars coming in the morning, you have 5 buses.
Okay, this is not an action item. Are there any comments? Jeremy.
I thanks for the presentation. Inspiring. And Jim, thanks for conducting the Green School meetings. They've been a pleasure to attend. I mean, this will obviously be an ongoing conversation, as Mr. Chakanaka so thoughtfully points out. If we're going to be serious about this, we're going to re-examine how we do virtually everything. It's funny, when we look at this presidential cycle, I don't see anybody talking about running on a Green New Deal, but perhaps Jill Stein has talked about that, but she polls at about half of 1%. I also think it's interesting, I appreciated the visual, because one of the things that you mentioned, Miami, there's streets in downtown Miami that flood every high tide. And to get to their shops, shop owners need to put on their galoshes. So we'll see if we can advance this issue, but I do think that the Green School Committee is a good place to start, and I do know that Ms. Murphy, as one of the people who works with science teachers would be very much on board to promote this. So thanks. I'm glad that you guys came tonight, and I appreciate it.
Sheila.
Well, I was going to say a similar thing. I'm really glad that you guys, you had to sit, be here through a long meeting, and that you stayed to speak about this. I have an office downtown in Santa Cruz, and I'm just a paranoid enough person that I had to figure out exactly where the tsunami lines were and where 20, you know, feet would be, and whether I could walk quickly enough from there up to where it's clear. And what it brought home to me was that our downtown, at least half of our downtown, is extremely vulnerable early on as soon as our weather begins to change dramatically. And I don't think that our older generation, when I talk to the older generation about it, everybody's kind of like, oh, yeah, yeah, that's not going to happen in any hurry. And I think it's the younger generation that knows this is something that has to change. I really appreciate the effort you put into coming here. I hear lots of great things about what's happening here at our university and in general in terms of trying to come up with solutions. So more power to you. Keep up the good work.
Ella, is your light on?
Yeah.
It's okay. Dying. It's very, yeah. Maybe you and Deb could share a light because I couldn't
yeah,
see.
Right.
Take Aaron's light. Go ahead, Ella.
I just wanted to thank you all for coming up and bringing up the topic. And I know there's a lot of big steps we can take, like bringing back bus routes, but there's also like smaller things, like people coming in and talking to the student environmental clubs. Mm-hmm. I think Santa Cruz High has two. I don't know why it's not just one big club, but there's two of them. And I know that when I was taking AP Environmental Science this year, there was a lot that came up that was like maybe just touched on in a day, but I wish I'd known earlier. And there's a lot of students who get really, really involved, but like me, they're really involved for one semester and then they go off to college and are really involved there, which is great, but doesn't have the same impact here as it could. And like again, like bringing home like the local reality too was something that we didn't really delve into, even though there's like two required science classes for high school students and you touch on science every year before that. This seems like a lot more relevant, and I know that it comes up in class discussions a lot, almost like I think in my English class more than mm-hmm. in science classes. So just having like a platform for student discussion would be huge too. Going forward with that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Jim, and thank you for everybody that spoke. We are at 8.3.5. Jim.
Thank you again.
Jeremy, did you have another
question?
No. Oh, I didn't know if you didn't take it down.
At this time, it's my distinct pleasure to call up Mr. Trevor Miller, our director of MOT, and he'll introduce our guest who's going to present on our Proposition 9 energy conservation program. It sounds similar. These propositions share the same number. We just talked about Prop 39 with the facility bond campaign that requires a 55% majority in the United States. Or in California, they re-rolled through the numbers, and a couple of years ago, they started Prop 39, the energy conservation program. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Miller and Tyler from Climate Tech.
Good evening, everybody. What a wonderful segue that was to get all that
action timing.
Something in action to make an actual difference. So, as you may recall, last year we did an RFQ for consultants to help us through the process of identifying the most useful and effective means by which to, one, lower our energy bill, but two, also reduce our carbon footprint at the same time. In light of the fact that we're also potentially going to be going through massive modernization projects and we don't want to put money into something that we're going to turn around and change shortly. So it's been a rather complicated process. We selected the company Climatech as probably the number one company in the nation that does this kind of work. So we're very lucky that they took us on as a client. So without further ado, I'll introduce Tyler Gerben from Climatech.
All right, thank you. Madam President, fellow board members, and Superintendent Monroe, I appreciate your time, and very exciting, you know, talking about the School Energy Committee and moving into the green aspect of this and seeing the polling results. I've been in a lot of these presentations before, and seeing the polling results of the bond is very, very excellent. So just a brief summary of Prop 39. It's a 5-year grant program from the state for districts, community colleges to upgrade their facilities and modernize and improve the energy efficiency. Santa Cruz City Schools combined with the elementary and high school district, about $1.29 million total for these upgrades over 5 years. However, the requirements are very, very strict. For every dollar spent, there has to be a savings of $1.05 back over the life of the equipment. The CEC approves all applications for the price as well as for the savings. And the CEC is the California Energy Commission as well. The process to date, like Trevor mentioned, has been a complicated process. We're very fortunate enough to partner with the district and be here after a competitive process. Our engineers, along with district staff, went and monitored each of the facilities, looked at the heating and cooling equipment, lighting equipment, etc. We also sat back down with staff to co-author and collaborate on a combined scope of work that would not only affect the learning environment, but also reduce your utility bills. And then we got together with Teeter & Associates, who you know is a long-term facility master plan provider, and we coordinated those efforts with them as well to make sure, like Trevor said, we weren't doing programs that were going to be reinvested in 5 years or 3 to 5 years from now. So the program goals is to improve the comfort of the classroom, but also reduce the utility bills and take care of deferred maintenance items, such as 20-year-old heating and cooling equipment and inefficient lighting systems throughout the campuses. And then most importantly, maximize the Prop 39 funds that you receive in order to stretch those future bond dollars. So the projects that are within this program will actually stretch those future bond dollars, so you don't have to use those future dollars for this program. The scope of work summary is new high efficient heating and cooling systems where you have air conditioning, as well as LED lighting systems at all sites and interior lighting systems at 9 sites as well. LED dimming control technologies, and this is by code. Each teacher in those locations would have the ability to lower and increase the light levels within their space. And then new heating and cooling controls, thermostats for the air conditioning units, and then pool pump VFD controls at the pool to make sure that that's running optimally as well. The financial highlights, again, together, Santa Cruz City Schools, $1.29 million in Prop 39. There was a project approved for lighting improvements up to LED for $121,000. That will be implemented this summer in coordination with this program. And then the remaining Prop 39 funds of $1.1 million. The scope of work that we discussed is roughly over $1 million here for the Prop 39 program, completely funded by the state. And all taxes, bonds, engineering, DSA, which is the state architects, everything is included. No change orders can be allocated in this project due to the code by the government as well. Life cycle savings of $2.6 million over the life of the equipment, as well as projected year one savings of $94,000 and year 1 through 5. Above and beyond the financial benefits of this program, this environmental equivalencies, it's taking 56 cars off the road on an annual basis and saving over 8,000 trees as well. The next steps, if we're fortunate enough, come back next board meeting, June 15th, seek approval. Then we would apply to the CEC, obtain approval, and then anticipated project start is late summer. We want to get and use the summertime as much as possible to implement some of these solutions. And with that, any questions?
I have a question, Madam President, please. Yes. I just want to clarify that this item then is an informational item and not an action item, because it's listed differently on the agenda.
So. Oh. I have it. This is information.
Informational.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. Are there questions? Patty?
My question being, from the application point that you speak to till the actual answer, you expect a very short time for these dollars to our project, so we've gone through our scope of events and gotten to from your
Yeah. We've been very fortunate enough to receive approval on over $56 million of Prop 39 funding for other districts. And so some of the measures that we're looking at here are pretty straightforward. And we know the timeline stretch for districts to get approved. That being said, it is a bureaucratic, California Energy Commission, and we work our diligently to get that approval as soon as possible.
And a follow-up to that is there is only so many dollars, so we are still far enough in the beginning of the lineup that we wouldn't anticipate any problems for the money. Thank you. I'm getting a nod, so thank you.
Sheila?
I'm sorry if I missed this while I stepped out, but can you explain why some are only three sites and some are all the sites? Is that because some of our sites are already upgraded?
So when we're looking at, for example, the heating and cooling units, the units that are mentioned here are your oldest ones that you have where there's air conditioning. Most of your sites actually just have heating only, which are different systems. As far as the lighting, the exterior lighting, we're touching every single site and upgrading a lot of the inefficient technologies. And then on the interior lighting side, there's nine sites out of the 11 because solar PV and low utility costs on the other two sites doesn't make it financially feasible to be within the program and the stringent requirements of the payback. For every dollar spent, it has to save $1.05 off your utility bill, and you have to prove that to the CPC. So there's a lot that goes into these variables, not only needs and priorities, but also the savings and cost of each element.
So are you saying that it's the air conditioned heating units are the ones that we are upgrading, but not the heating units?
For the 11 units mentioned here, it's air conditioning and heating units for areas such as the library or admin center. There's also a couple of units that are on the classroom, but you're correct. There's many more systems out there that need to be replaced that the bond would come in and take care of, but these would work within this program.
And the three sites are?
The three sites, I have a feeling that was going to come up in a second. Bayview, Brantford, and Harvard.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I put my light on. I have a question. I'm wondering if De La Viega is listed as one of the sites that we'll get. We've heard from people at the board, parents that have come in and talked about how hot it is in some of the classrooms in De La Viega. I'm wondering if this is an opportunity to address that issue.
No, in this particular case, there's specific guidelines that are set by the state, and the energy efficiency level that must be reached.
Okay.
It takes into consideration the ones that we can impact. Okay. To retrieve the savings.
So we can only replace things based on energy efficiency needs.
Mm-hmm.
And Dee Dee?
I just want to clarify, the board's going to vote on this on June 15th, and you expect to start this and get it approved by the CEC by July?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Where are we?
As a point of reference, the project that was alluded to earlier about the gym lighting took about 10 days. Yeah.
So when they're clean, well done, and well presented, they tend to move through fairly quickly. The different ones get pushed aside for other ones. So.
There's no ADA issues or topographical issues with these, so it's, when we see the long time, it usually has to do with ADA compliance or some kind of topography issue that is getting in the way.
Ella.
I guess just ditto what Allison said, although about the Sanchez High heating system, would that be one of the sites that just has heating and isn't being updated?
Yeah, I think it's just
correct. Okay. And the thing we want to do is one of the key components of doing this process, we had ClimateTech make sure and touch base, as he mentioned, with Peter and Associates, how it works in conjunction with the long-range plan. Because one of our goals was, we don't want to put in all this lighting or check some units that end up being pulled out if we're successful in November. So that's part of this whole piece. We try to work together to make sure we're putting these others to be really efficient, create the energy savings, create the financial savings it has to do. And part of the next step that Connor alluded to is part of this project does have that information first, then it brought back to you as a board with a resolution to show the savings do exceed the cost of the project, as well as a public hearing by terms of two-pronged event for this particular proposition. As the state they give us more restrictions to work within. So,
Sheila. So I have to get a little concrete here because I know this is going to come up in the community. Why isn't the La Viega under the energy, did you say energy efficiency criteria? Like,
and that's the site where you're adding, you want to add air conditioning, right? Because it's hot. So when you add air conditioning, you actually add more electrical load. So it actually goes the other way. Rather than conserving energy, you're actually using more, and therefore would
it's not replacing it.
Prop 39. However, it would be cooling and efficient for the classroom, but for the Prop 39 stringent requirements, we can't do that.
Trevor, can you speak to what has been done to address that issue at De La Viega?
So one of the interesting things we discovered, in trying to take advantage of all these different programs, we came across a PG&E program that provided us with electrical engineers that are highly trained in digital controls and the magic behind the computer controls of heating and cooling units in general. So at two of our sites, we discovered in the process that there's a component on a unit that when the temperature rises, it actually is supposed to shut the vents. So when it's cool enough and you just need cool air, they open 100%, let all cool air in to keep the room comfortable. And as the heat rises outside, they're supposed to close off, never 100%, but to about 80-85%, always have the appropriate oxygen-nitrogen balance in the air, oxygen CO2, so the students don't get dopey. However, what we discovered in the programming that was done back 10, 15 years ago is that those weren't being controlled. So they were 100% open all the time. So what happens is as you got higher temperatures outside and the room temperature started coming up with the student load, instead of closing down to at least keep that 70 rising with students slowly, it would start just keep dragging that 80, 85, 90 degree air in and raising it even faster. So literally within an hour, it would be outside temperature above because you've got the heat load in students. So through that process, discovering that, we have now reprogrammed the system. So although it'll still get hot late in the afternoon, it'll take a lot longer throughout the day to get there. We hope that makes things a lot more bearable. We've also purchased a series of, and they're a different type of fan, they're very quiet, but they're also got a cooling component by the way they work, some sort of magic in static electricity, to also try to alleviate the problem until such time as we can get there. Hopefully with some more money, change the educational environment.
Thank you.
Are there comments from the public?
Okay, this is not an action item. Any last comments?
Good presentation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your support.
Third interim report.
We're going to do the May revise first, so thank you all for pulling that up. So we've been fortunate in going through the RFP just as we segue. We had some quality vendors that came forward to manage the plan for us. And Climate Tech worked closely with Mr. Jack O'Connell's capital advisors group, which helped kind of the interview process, helped us decide which was the best candidate for the district. So that's what we're trying to do. So tonight we're going to be a two-part process of the financial piece. One, we just returned last week, I think Ms. Parks mentioned, we went to our Superintendent Monroe to the Governor's May revise. So we're going to give you information on the general consensus on the state of California, and then roll that into our third interim presentation. So we should have two, and I know just for the sake of your time, and we'll go through these with the important parts highlighted. So the May revise, again, Proposition 98 still governs how schools are funded in California. It's rising, but at a much lower rate. So, you know, Governor Brown, part of his legacy, one, is not wanting to incur more debt at the state level, most importantly for him, as well as if funds come in, he has been basically the king of one-time dollar allocation versus continually adding the dollars to the district's ongoing resources. In the past, it always seemed that he would underproject, or the state would underproject, and money would come in higher at the May revise. Well, this is the year that they're basically right on target. There isn't going to be a large increase to that prognostication from Sacramento. So the key component the governor really is concerned about is preparing for the slowdown. We've had an extended period of growth. How much, again, is still debatable at the state level for an ongoing time. And he's really concerned about what's going to happen potentially when the shoe does fall. He still projects that the local control funding formula, which is how the schools are funded via the Prop 98, will be about 96% implemented in 2016-17. At full implementation, basically, the large dollar amounts we saw with the growth of funds really becomes much less, becomes a minimal growth factor because the gap and the amount they chose to say this is the point you're going to receive as a district, that gap has lessened to a large degree. As part of their current assumptions, they're saying Prop 30 is going to expire, and it's set to expire right around December of 2018. They're projecting very low cost of living adjustments, and they're projecting lower growth in Prop 98, which is the funding vehicle. And this is one, and we presented the same presentation yesterday to the Budget Advisory Committee, and this is one where you really can, and I even get lost as a district person about the test factors. It basically is based upon the growth within the state. The state will determine under what test factor they're going to fund schools. And there's three factors. Test one would basically say is we're going to get a fixed share of the general fund revenues. You know, there's a general fund, O1, at the state level. And based upon that growth, which would award schools the most money, the state gets to determine when that gets into place. There's test two, which is based upon growth in the per capita personal income. And we saw a lot of that last year, you know, with the capital gains that came into effect that added a lot to the coffers. And then there's test three, which is just based upon growth in the per capita general fund. Okay. Now, one of the short stories I told yesterday is the person that actually wrote Prop 98 actually expired within this past year. So there's probably about five or six gentlemen they project that really know Prop 98 intimately. I can attest to you, I am not one of them, as trying to interpret this language they put into place. But the state will determine how they're going to allocate the shares of dollars based upon these test factors. Why the test factors become important is it also ties into the rainy day fund. Is that the rainy day fund comes into existence when the state basically doesn't owe us any money and we're under test one. Well, they're saying right now we're going to be under test three next year as a state. Okay. So compared to 2011-12, the Prop 98 guarantee, it's going to increase. We've seen that growth in the last couple of years. It's going to be up to $71.9 billion under the May revision. That's for the total state itself. A lot of it that we're seeing, a lot of the gains are due to this Prop 98 maintenance factor, the restoration of our purchasing power. But in some ways, the state will think it's a repayment and we're giving you additional money. It's a restoration of that purchasing power we had back in 07-08. And according to the May revision, a key component is there's still going to be about $908 million in monies outstanding to schools in 16-17. They paid off quite a portion, down to about $155 million, but they created another outstanding bill of $746 million based upon carrying that forward for 16-17. So the key component, again, is the funding will continue to slow because this maintenance factor is really decreasing. So think about where it was a couple of years ago compared to less than $1 billion now. They're projecting growth in about the 2 to 4% range annually after 16-17. So what are the implications for us in education? The governor really feels that the economic expansion could be slowing down significantly. And that's one of the key concerns he's talked about, increasing the burden of debt to California. He sees slow or no growth in income taxes and sales taxes, which account for about 90% of the general fund revenues in the state. And the May revision is built on the fact that Proposition 30 will not be continued. Now, again, that will change come November, but that is on the ballot for the year. And then if a recession occurs and Prop 30 is not extended, we'll probably see state revenues begin to dip again from where they were. So, as when we saw during the height of the last recession, where do they go to first when they couldn't fund all of their programs? Could happen again. Could. I'm just not saying it will. I'm saying it could. So here's some significant changes of where we were from January to May, and to see the very minimal change of what occurred based upon what they were seeing in January and in May. So it's not a huge fluctuation in dollars. And you see it's very, very minimal. One of the key components is on the 2016-17 cost of living adjustment. They had projected in January a 0.47, less than 0.5% increase. Based upon the current changes in May, they've lowered the COLA to zero for 16-17, the cost of living adjustment. And that affects in many ways special ed funding. It affects the base grant that we'll go over at the state level a little bit in a couple of slides. And it affects some categorical programs. So we're not going to see any increase in those particular programs whatsoever. One thing we are seeing is the governor, again, it's the one-time discretionary funds. He is currently projecting in his budget an increase from $214 per average daily attendance to $237. So an increase of about 23 bucks based upon students going to school. So what is the statutory COLA goes to zero? Again, what they're saying is there's not going to be an increase. There'll be no COLA applied to the local control funding formula. It won't be applied to special ed, to the categorical programs. And if there's been any LEAs that were already at their targets, we're not one of them, but they will see basically no increase at all from what was being projected in January. So as we continue to do this piece of it, the second bullet point is really the area that we kind of focus on. The implementation target for this year is 54%, just under 55%, excuse me. So basically, with the governor allocating the dollars that he has in the restoration of the maintenance factor, he's closed that gap of about 87% of what he said they wanted to do over an 8-year period. So basically, that gap has shrunk, so there's just a smaller amount to meet now to get there. They reached also about 96% of the targeted funding levels at districts. Okay, some districts receive higher growth, some don't. But they reached about 96% in closing that gap. Again, no COLA, and on an average, districts, especially those that have supplemental and concentration dollars, will receive an increase of about 5.94%, or about $520 per AEA. Again, it just gives you an idea of what the trend.
I'm going to interrupt.
Sure.
Are we an average district?
No, we're not an average district. Well, educationally, we're higher than average, we would say.
Thank you.
Financially, we're not. And not under the current funding formula.
And so what is our percentage?
Right now, we're projected to be, right now, based upon the current numbers, right around 3.5%. Could raise a little bit based upon what happens when it finally gets shaken up per student, as far as the increase overall. A lot of it coming in one-time dollars. And that becomes our challenge, because when most school districts have 85% of employees and benefits, that becomes kind of the challenge that we have. Again, this just shows the growth of the trend, what it's been with the gap with the local control funding formula. And here's the targets we talked about. There's no change. So K-3 students receive this year $7,000, tad above, per student. We'll receive the same thing in 16-17, all the way down to 9-12. So that's the basic grant that we'll receive for students if they came to every day of school that we had. The grade span adjustments also are not effective. There's no COLA, so you won't see an increase in the grade span adjustment. For example, our K-3 dollars that we do to help allocate lower class sizes, there's no cost of living adjustment to that either. So that just remains flat from where we were in 15-16. And this just gives you an idea of what the supplemental and concentration grants, because they are not going to be raised either. So again, those were the additional dollars that districts will receive based upon their free and lunch percentage and a duplicated count. Discretionary funds, again, this is another way that the government has tried to take advantage of the same dollar more than once. The one-time dollars are basically dollars that were owed to districts for services we provided. We provided at a much higher rate than what we should receive, so it's an outstanding balance. So even though these dollars are from growth in the income, growth in the state income level for the last couple of years, the governor's saying, I'm giving you this money to offset my credit card bill to schools from the past. So he's kind of getting credit both ways. One, the economy has grown, so I'm going to give you more one-time dollars, but the one-time dollars are being used to pay down dollars that we owe you. Hmm. So in other words, we're happy we're receiving it. It's one-time dollars, but he's trying to erase that wall of debt that was also incurred by the government at the same time. So that's the key component. And we are receiving, like you mentioned, $237. That's projected right now, and that's still going on for a debate in Sacramento. So what does the LCFF mean for us? Currently, we're projecting the elementary average per ADA funding of about $8,400. Our projected ADA is $2,600, a tad above it. Right now, we're projecting revenue about $22 million for the elementary portion of our district. On the secondary side, we feel we're average about $9,100 per student, with projected ADA of $3,900, a tad above that, about $36 million. So our budget for a district as a whole, which runs about $70 million, about $58 million, $58.5 million comes from this local control funding formula, which are the dollars that are used to offset all of our expenses that we have, the majority of them that we do. And at the bottom, you see the discretionary one-time funds that will come to us. This time last year, the one-time funds were over $500. So we're grateful for the 237, but again, it's a decrease from what we received last year in one-time funds. So it's going to be very judicious in how we allocate those out. Again, this is a key component. And this happens, again, through nothing that the district has done incorrectly. This is based upon the fact that the state has a large unfunded liability based upon the retirement programs. And we're saying you, the employer, needs to pay that increase. And we've talked about this kind of ad nauseum, but again, it's just a critical place marker for us as a district. These rates will increase no matter what we want to say or do. And that's where we really have to create the advocacy with our lobbyists and with our local legislators to see how districts like us are not average. This is where we are severely impacted because we don't receive the supplemental concentration dollars on top of the base grant to offset the growth, not just in CalSTRS, but also the growth in CalPERS, the requirement for the district. So it affects both sides of the house. And again, nothing that we've done incorrectly. This is just what the legislature and the government says. This is who's going to pay for it, you as the employer. Another key change of what the governor is saying, it's up to you at the local level to make sure that your buildings are in a position of repair and that they offer a great educational environment. He's really against putting any bond dollars at the state level to include or increase that wall of debt. So they're bringing back the routine restricted maintenance requirement. And basically what this is at the state level, that we must set aside 3% of our general fund expenses included in that calculation is money set aside for routine restricted maintenance. At the height of the economic recession, that requirement was dropped to 1%. But we still maintain our individuals, maybe decrease the footprint to drop within that level. But the requirement going back into effect is we must have set aside 3% of our dollars to meet this requirement. You know, whether it's facility individuals, projects, et cetera, that we do to maintain our facilities. So again, here's a Cliff Notes version of what we're doing right now. We received the May revise. They're going through the House with budget subcommittees, train their bills to determine how they're really going to do this. Because by June 15th, I will assure you, we will have a signed budget. Because if not, the legislators will not get paid. And I think some of these legislators have spouses that enjoy their little trips, just like any of ours do, and they don't want to miss a paycheck. So there will be a budget in place that will continue to be adjusted, not just after June 15, but probably over the summer with trader bills that we'll have to do. And we will continue to update this and bring the information to you as quickly as possible. So with that, we'll answer any questions here before we go into how this information is affecting our current calculation as a district. Member Sheldon.
Quick question. As you pointed out many times, our elementary district is basic aid. Are we projecting, and this is just purely anecdotal evidence on my part, it seems like a lot of houses are selling for a lot of money. What is our projection in terms of increased dollars for elementary, and might it not come in a little bit higher?
Well, it may. We project at both the high school and the secondary and elementary level to have a 2% increase on property taxes. Now, I don't have the graph in front of me that we presented to you a couple of months ago, that has been average, fluctuating up and down,
yes,
when you're negative.
I remember that.
So it may come in about 3.5%, maybe around 4% at the elementary level. And that specifically will add to the bottom line. At the secondary levels we've talked about,
it doesn't matter
because the taxes go up, they'll decrease state aid because we're hinged upon the funding form.
Quick follow-up question, when will we know that number? Because it could help us.
The final number won't be known until we close the books in September. We will get the final numbers as the county goes through itself. The county of Santa Cruz, not the Office of Ed, they go through and calculate this across the whole county. And we'll get that close to probably the end of August, early September, which will be part of our calculation.
Sheila.
Okay, I have two questions, but I'll start with one. Back on the LCFF page where you talked about what the figure is going to be for this year, I was wondering how that compares to the figure for last year.
As far as our ADA is,
projected ADA.
ADA, well, here's the thing. In the state of California, you would take the higher of your current year or the previous year. So right now, we're going to use the ADA from this year because our ADA is stated to fall for next year.
So that again,
in California, you have the ability to take the higher of one of 2 years' average ADA attendance. Your previous year or your current year of budget. So in 16-17, we are going to use our actual ADA of 15-16 because that's what's guaranteed. So, which is a decrease from our average daily attendance in 14-15. So you'll probably see a slight decrease in attendance and the grant being flat. Because we're not increasing the grant per student.
Okay.
Patty?
Just a quick follow-up question to Jeremy's to make sure that I'm straight. Do we do the basic aid calculation yearly or?
Yes, yearly.
Yes, okay. I just wanted to be sure. Thank you.
Four times a year, at least. First interim, second interim, now third interim, and closing the books.
So those dollars?
As we get information from the county of the percentages, a lot of times they remain flat until we get the actual dollar.
Okay, thank you.
Dee Dee?
Can we go back to slide 8? Because you lost me yesterday on this one, and it's no clearer today.
I'm not doing a good job.
Oh, no.
the dollars to the fraud.
The slight factor.
One more.
So the ADA is supposed to be 237 for our district, and that bottom bullet about the average increase per pupil of 5.94%, we are not eligible for that,
right?
Because we do not have the numbers.
The higher free and reduced under the Dayton County.
The demographic,
right.
Numbers. So
what you'll find, I'm sorry to interject, you'll find some districts that'll be above this amount, 7-8%. You'll find some that are gonna be 3 or 2% based upon the makeup of their student base. So it's not consistent. This is the average across the state.
Hence Chris's comment that we are not that.
We are not the average.
But you also said that something about that we're at 4-point-something%. That's where I saw.
Okay. Based upon what we're calculating on the per growth per ADA, right now we're projecting about a 3.5% compared to the 5.94 for our district. As we do our current calculation,
okay,
the increase will be there per ADA.
Okay.
And again, that's based upon the makeup.
And that's one-time money.
Most of it will come from one-time money and the overall growth across the whole district. So the majority of dollars coming to the districts now, there's the maintenance factor, there's shortening or the gap, decreasing the gap, okay, but there's also the one-time money. So the average per student in the state is averaging about $520. Again, as many districts in California will be as many dollars and percentages that make up each district.
So I'm going to try to explain it in a different way. So we have some new revenue coming in. Okay, so even though there wasn't a COLA, there is some more work to close that gap. Whereas the average district's going to see almost 6%, we're not. We're going to see about 3.5%, and that's a combination of closing the gap dollars and this one-time payback dollars for state mandates that they're paying us back for in one-time monies. So although we are an exceptional district in many ways, we are don't fall in into we fall below average in funding from the state.
Because of our demographics.
Correct.
So that 3% is above the 237
to 88. That's where I'm it incorporates the whole increase to the district.
Okay.
It incorporates all the new dollars coming to our district next year.
Across the elementary and secondary.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Correct.
Thank you.
And it is, because if you talk about it, you know, for 40 years we had this calculation. Here's your student. You're going to get $7,000 per student, K through 12. Now it literally is an 8-tab Excel sheet that has, okay, here's your K through 3, here's your 4 through 6, here's your 7, 8, here's your 9 through 12, here's your concentration grant, here's your supplemental dollar that has to follow that specific student to get to your minimum percentage proportionality, which is part of the local control.
This was the governor's simplification.
It's a simplification of funding.
This was the governor's simplification.
So this is the big picture look. Okay. So what we've done, if I can have Ms. Molly take us to the next presentation, which is less, but this is the background that we just received last Wednesday. So we worked on this the last couple of days, presented this to the Budget Advisory Committee. I think Ms. Thompson, Ms. Coonerty.
I had a question on 8 before you took off from it.
Okay. Well, it's off. I'm sorry.
Do you want me to go back?
Unless I could find it on here and Jim will. Okay, well, one part was just the answer to that. So that's a 5-point-something%, and it gave us $540. So a 3.5% would give us approximately...
Probably about $350 per student.
$350, okay. And then I know you said this all yesterday, and
you
said it all again today. So I was wide awake, and despite the fact that I was wide awake, can you one more time explain the 87% of the gap closed in the first 4 years versus the 95.7 of the targeted funding levels?
Right.
That just loses me.
Right. What happens, each district, in order to get back to their purchasing power of 0708, has a maximum target that they're going to receive based upon this new calculator. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So they'll say, for example, let's say, just to make it simple, each student in Santa Cruz, the maximum target is $10,000 per student. So when we started this whole local control funding formula 4 years ago, we were saying $8,000. So to get to that gap of $8,000 to $10,000, here is this chasm of dollars that the state had to make up. So they begin to chunk away on an annual basis. I think the first year, gosh, now you're really testing me, was 13%. Then we went to 24% of the gap. And each year that gap actually shrunk to where this year they're giving us 55% of the gap itself to get us to that final target amount per student within the district. Okay. On an average now, based upon, even though they closed the gap by 95%, 87% of that, or 87% of the gap has been closed to get us to that target level of 95%.
87% of the gap has been closed that will get us to the
95%.
Okay, now I got it. Hopefully.
Before we say
now the piece about it is what was not included in this calculation for the target level, what was done in this target, what is not included. Is the increase to the districts of Persons Terms. So that is one reason why we feel we will never get to that 100% target level as a district. Because that increase to district was not included in the original calculation of the funding.
Before we start the third intro, since we've done a round of questions, I just want to see if there are any questions or comments from the public before we move on to the third intro report. Are we good?
Thanks, Jim.
Okay, so how does this affect us? The key component of the third interim report is not a requirement of our district because at the time we were not qualified. Okay. A third interim would be necessary if we were a qualified district, meaning that in one of our 3 years we were not going to be able to meet our potential payments and meet the 3% reserve. But one of the things we committed to when I arrived was to do this really as a way to keep the board and the stakeholders current on what our financial picture was. So what you're going to see up here is going to be what are the significant changes that have occurred from second interim and this new calculator that we received with the governor's May revise, and what does that do to change our numbers within our district? And again, just to let you know, all of these presentations are online under the business page of the district, so you can go back a whole year to pull up information that we presented every interim report. So what we're seeing based upon the new calculation is an increase in our local control funding formula sources of about $223,000. We're seeing a decrease in our federal programs from second to third interim of about $138,000. Okay. And again, you gotta realize because the state and the federal government is constantly working at least probably on 3 years' time. They're still closing out grants from 14-15 based upon information that is sent to them. Okay, so that's why they'll come back and say, well, we're gonna change some of the allocation factors for current year programs based upon previous year's information. State programs are seeing an increase of about $110,000. So we lost them on the federal level, but we're seeing somewhat of a close match from the state level. And local programs, we're seeing an increase of $350,000. Local dollars, believe it or not, are sometimes special ed dollars that are received at the local level, increases in donations, increases in local dollars that come to us from our local constituents. Parcel tax revenue, again, that's going to be similar to what we talked about with the property taxes. We won't have these final numbers till September as the county balances this book. So we keep that pretty flat based upon the dollar. The transfers in, as we mentioned yesterday, you're seeing an increase in $150,000 that came into the general fund because this was based upon the board direction. We bought two new buses that were absolutely essential. It came into the general fund from our deferred maintenance fund, which is Fund 14. What are changes in unrestricted expenditures? So we went home last night based upon the BAC. Specifically, we see an increase in certificated expenses of about $514,000. Went back, there's been an increase of about $100,000, Casey and Elaine and Barry and the rest, for EWAs, extra work agreements that have occurred as we finish out the year. There's been a $100,000 increase to substitutes throughout the whole district in the budget. And there's a $300,000 approximately increase in education protection account dollars, which is at the EPA, which is the prop, we get information from the state that updates, and money that comes from EPA goes directly back in certificated salaries. That's one of the things that we have in our plan, the EPA, which is Prop 30. Those are constantly being adjusted upwards and downwards. So that's where we're seeing an increase in this piece. Extra work agreements, stipends, and EPA Prop 30. Okay? Classified, there's been a slight increase, and we do this based upon negotiations that we did and were closed out by the district. Benefits, $108,000, that'll be tied to changes in plans, changes in individuals, if we had any hires, etc. People come on EWA, people coming on substitute, maybe long term. So that's a small change from where we were at second interim. Books and supplies, this isn't specific relation to direction from the board of seeing why do we see such large differentiations in that. And that came from the workshop we had previously looking at supplies and restrictions. And we're going to show you later how we set those dollars aside now in the budget itself. So we're a key comment yesterday was, well, now we see where the dollars really are allocated. Capital outlay, of course, and you see the transfers out, that increased by $150,000 based upon the buses. So this gives you an idea of where were our changes in our unrestricted fund balance, because the unrestricted fund balance really is going to make up for any type of restricted expense if they can't meet those necessary expenses. Beginning fund balance stays the same, of course. Our deficit spending decreased again because we're moving that dollars out of that book and supply line. Okay, specifically to offset that area there. Okay. Gives us an ending fund balance where you see for the remainder of this year, third interim about 8.4. And it's broken out based upon, you'll see the legally restricted line of $2.7 million. And this is, again, specific direction of the board to say, okay, we see this huge dollar in books and supplies that you budget every year. And again, as we talked about a couple of months ago, this is the holding account where a lot of districts put it in because it was one of the most fluid, for lack of a better term. But we're now putting in this legally restricted account because these are dollars that could be out of the unrestricted side, but are specifically earmarked for expenses. Okay. It could be a donation, it could be some type of unrestricted dollar, it could be a supplemental piece. These are dollars that have to be spent on specific factors. And so that's why you see that difference in that books and supply line, and now we're showing it in a legally restricted line, just to show that piece of where it needs to go. That was, again, from specific requests of how we can make this even hopefully easier to understand and see where it is. We don't see those huge fluctuations. And I'll be sharing this directly with my successor as we get close to that point. The 3% reserve, again, that's based upon what our expenses are. We have to have that piece in place. And unassigned is basically, you would see our savings account, our rainy day fund, to meet any type of increase. Salary, property taxes that had come in at their rate. We had an unexpected expense, something, a sewer pipe busted that we had to pay out of a certain line or something, you know. This is that piece above and beyond that 3% minimum that we have as a district. So how does that affect us as a district? Again, what's required? 15-16, 16-17, 17-18. Okay, and right now we're showing to be a little bit above 3% in year three. But again, as a district, we're never that, I guess you could say, simple to understand, because we're already working on the 16-17 budget. So a 16-17 budget, our 3 years now are 16-17, 17-18, and 18-19, and those effects. Again, this is just staying flat line with our current funding or our current employee number for 16-17, 17-18, and the out year. So right now that number looks a little scary because it shows a negative number. But again, we haven't taken into consideration what the effect of the out years are going to be. We'll do that during this budget process, because again, our goal is we want to get to be or remain positive versus any type of qualified or negative. So we'll take a look at where is our funding going to be based upon projection. Will there be a decrease in some ways in salaries or et cetera along the lines there? So that's our current MYP. We are still positive with the third interim, but we're beginning to build that third year out as part of this budget process. As we get more information from the trade review, more information from the governor, when it gets signed on June 15th. So what's on the horizon? We're going to continue to incorporate state budget changes as they come to us. Continue to update the calculator. Will we get information from the county to look at taxes? We don't know, but we'll make those changes if appropriate. While we're creating the budget that has to come for a hearing on June 15, we'll also begin to close books, because that process happens. You know, we're 10, 15 days away, calendar days, from graduation. So we're ready to begin to work on closing out that cycle while we're creating the new budget. There'll be a public hearing for the LCAP, which will be led by my astute colleague to my left, Ms. Meeker, and her team. We'll have the public hearing for the budget on 2015-16. We'll have a hearing for 39 now, as you learned tonight. And then on June 22nd will be the formal adoption of the budget. The board still sees to do. July 1 is Happy New Year. It's a new school year. That's when we have celebration for us in the district. We continue to close out the old, but we get in the process of rolling over to the new. Our goal is to continue to match our projected resources to potentially projected decreases in students. And how do we continue to potentially look at areas to reduce our expenses in the out years? So we ask the board to approve the third interim financial report tonight. And of course, as you know, I got to leave a little bit of peace. And we learned this quite well with our facility steering group or committee. There's no decision that we can make that doesn't come with some sort of balance or sacrifice, which basically I kind of used yesterday, is that there could be some programs that Member Vestal and Member Kunert are going to be just adamant and happy that we maintain. At the same time, when we're doing that, it may not meet the interest of Member Tracy Prue or Member Perez Granados. It's just, we're not going to be able to make everybody happy. But we're just trying to take a look at what's going to maintain the district at the sound fiscal level. That's been my goal, you know, since my arrival, trying to continue to this day. So with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Jeremy.
Very quick question. The drop-off from 15-16 to 16-17 is 0.72%, from 7.8 to 7.8. And then it falls off precipitously to 3.2 and then to, into the negatives. Why is the decrease accelerated so much? Just in your...
Yeah, a lot of it comes from the PERS responsibility for the district.
But those responsibilities increase next year just as much as they'll increase 2 years out,
right,
or 3 years out.
Step and column increases for employees. There's no new dollars attached to it to offset those particular growths. You know, and in 2018, December, is we have to begin.
I understand that, but I did, okay. I'm still a little bit confused by how we go. We decrease by so much from 16-17 to 17-18.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be a combination of ADA, which drives a lot of the calculation, as that decreases, and the funding level. And there's, for example, also the one-time dollars go away. You're talking about $1.5 million of one-time dollars we don't receive in 17-18. That has to come off the books. There's no projection of additional one-time dollars.
The one-time dollars that we got for 3 years.
In a row.
Got it. And next year is our second year in it, and the year.
And it decreased from $500 per ADA next year to $237. And right now, one-time dollars are projected in 17-18 at zero.
Huh. Less income, more expense.
Yes.
Dee Dee?
A clarification question about the books and supplies that switch over.
Mm-hmm.
It was roughly $2.3 million.
Mm-hmm. A change of about 2.5.
Mm-hmm. And you took that out and put it into this legally
restricted balance
category that's 2.7.
Mm-hmm.
So where's the
additional donations that have occurred between second and third interim, dollars that come in that are restricted. So we're trying to create this whole path of dollars that really come in an unrestricted manner, but in many ways they're earmarked for specific expenses, potentially from donors or local.
So donations, not grant money or anything like that?
It could be a combination of unrestricted dollars that come in. Could be donations. I can get really finite to break it all down for you.
Yeah.
It'll tie closely to, if you went back to our presentation that's on our website, when we broke down all those funds,
yeah.
It'll tie closely to that.
Are educator effectiveness dollars in there, for example?
That's right.
Write that.
That's
right.
Okay. What was
those,
that?
And we had those over 3 years spent paying the grant we received last year. We could spend over 3 years. We spend that down. Those dollars aren't being replaced.
Okay.
But we're serving.
Right.
The good thing, we're serving, you know, our staff and our kids with those dollars.
Thanks.
Go ahead, Jeremy.
I should know this. We're not getting much interest on that $3.5 million, are we? We're getting like 0.5%.
Not yet. We're invested in with the county.
Not taking it to Las Vegas or not putting it in the stock market.
No.
Got it.
Correct.
Sheila.
And my last one. I have a couple, so I was looking to see if I was last. First of all, I wanted to ask you, can that issue of what is in the legally restricted, I think it's going to come up. People are going to be asking that. And is there a way to mark this so that they know where to go to find that answer?
Mm-hmm.
So that it's like you told us, but the average person wouldn't be able to figure that out.
Right. So you want more information on that?
Yeah, I think it'll come up, like, what are you talking about, legally restricted? Specifically, and I'm thinking that some of them are probably year to year, and others are unusual and new. So, I mean, at least the year to year, it would seem like would be easy enough to make sure that people could find and know. And then new, maybe not so easily.
Okay.
Is that right? Am I right about that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We'll do our darndest. Remember that we're pulling this information off a report that's about 160 pages in length.
Right.
That we try to really simplify in about 9 to 10 slides,
right,
to provide all the information. So.
Right, but I think this is one of those ones that's going to come up that nobody else is going to find in a report that's that long either. And then the education protection accounts,
mm-hmm.
You went flying back by that, and I'm like pedaling my bicycle. Can you just go over that? $300,000 of that money was...
That's Proposition 30. That's the update we received from the state. Again, as they go through the cycle of balancing the books from Prop 30, which is, it was also known as the Education Protection Account. That's the original Prop 30 that's in place right now.
Okay.
And so what we're being sent is an increase in Prop 30 dollars of about $300,000 on our third interim calculation, and how our current plan is that goes specifically to offset certificated salaries. That's part of our plan that we do on an annual basis. So it was a way for the government to say, we're going to give you Prop 30 dollars, we're going to offset that by taking that same dollar amount from your state allocation.
We don't understand. Can you explain it?
Prop 30?
How the dollars come up in a negative.
On an annual basis, in fact, we'll bring in June, is the majority of Prop 30 dollars go directly to teacher salaries. Okay. So the current calculation we just received on is an increase of Prop 30 dollars of $300,000. So we will allocate that specifically to certificated salaries to offset that piece. Okay. So as we go through and close the books, and the state will finalize the actual Prop 30 allocation of dollars in our plan, it'll go specifically to offset teacher salaries. Okay. There could potentially be a $300,000 savings in the unrestricted fund that gets allocated to Prop 30 certificated salaries, or it'll also be used to offset any increases we have between now and we close the books. If there's additional extra work agreements, if there's additional substitute dollars that have to be adjusted as we close out the year. So all those dollars, but our Prop 30 dollars, which is currently in place, our plan as a district was to be used specifically for teacher salaries. And that was consistent across basically every district in the state. It was used to offset salaries.
I just want to close. I have board questions before we move out to the public. We'll do that very soon. Okay. Are there any other questions from board members?
I have one more. I just want to make sure I understand this in the simplest way possible. The unassigned category. Mm-hmm. That's where if we, in order to get an administrator that we need, we decide to increase a salary, or when we make a negotiation with the teachers or the classified, that's where that money sits when we make that change mid-year?
It's for any increase in unrestricted expenses.
Those are some of the innies. Okay, that's all I wanted to make sure that I had that right. Thank you.
Okay, no more board questions. We'll open it up for public comment or questions. Come on, you guys are all. Tim, you had your hand up. Do you have a question? Let's stick with.
Thank you.
Hi, Tim Adson, talk for questions. The Prop 30 Education Protection Act money, you showed it as an increase in teacher salary expenses, which to me would imply that if you get extra money for Prop 30, you then will pay out a bonus of $300,000 to the teachers. I'm sure they aren't bigger than that, but that's what it looks like when by increasing the expense line item.
We specifically increased the expense line item, and then as we close the book, throughout the rest of the whole summertime piece of it, could it create a savings to the general fund of $300,000 to offset it? Possibly, if we don't have any other certificated increases or expenses that we have to meet from the unrestricted side. This is what the state did in the Prop 30 Education Protection Account. Is we said, based upon the calculation, you as a district are going to receive $2 million. Okay? They then took that $2 million off their unrestricted allocation to be offset by the Prop 30 dollars. So it was an increase in the allocation of dollars, but reallocated the expense from the unrestricted side to the Prop 30 dollars.
It's a balance sheet. It's the debit credit issue, except, and it's a point in time. But why would we hold it? I guess I'm wondering why it doesn't free up immediately into the bottom line in a different way. It was already coming in. It's just allocating, saying that
right.
It was coming in that way. So it's not new money. It's just marked money.
Marked.
And it had to go in. It had to come in. And so for the balance of it,
you're saying instead of dropping it the other way to the bottom line, should there be any dollars, you hold it there at the moment of time in the report until the expenses are all flushed out at the end of the
especially now year. Third interim.
Okay. It's a
and as this changes
it's an accounting, not a math.
As this changing, we will bring back how it affects the unrestricted side. I'll leave that with my successor.
Okay.
Any other public comment?
I got one more question.
Sheila.
You look so calm. Do you understand this all? It's really hard. Okay, this I'm going to reveal my stupidity here, but that $514,000 is an expenditure. You're talking about it in terms of coming in as money we get, but it's actually increasing the expenditure, and that's, I think, where you're losing me.
We have, so what we've changed, we added $100,000 of increased extra work agreements from second interim. We've added $100,000 of substitutes
right.
as an expense. Okay. As the dollars get allocated from Prop 30, it will also specifically increase certificated salary increases because that's exactly where we plan on an annual basis for all Prop 30 dollars to go.
So, but it's an expenditure. It's showing up as more of an expenditure. Mm-hmm. It doesn't show up as more money being brought
in. It also increases our sources under the local control funding formula. So we'll have an offset to that also on that side.
Okay.
Remember we showed about $200,000? If we went back to $223,000 of LCFF sources that have changed. So we've increased the revenue about $220,000 overall and increased expenses by about $500,000. Just on certificate, we increased $600,000 on the classified side. Again, when we put this together, we're not just looking at, say, certificate, we're not just looking at classified, we're looking at the whole district as a whole as it's affected by the changes in third interim. And we'll continue to flush out all these dollars as we close the books out.
Okay.
Okay, this is an action item, and the recommendation is to accept the third interim report.
Move approval.
It's Patty.
Second.
Thank you.
Student recommendation?
Aye.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstain?
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
And Molly, 8.3.7.
So I bring forth today our declaration of need for fully qualified educators. Of course, this is our goal every year, is to have fully qualified teachers in every classroom in our district. This is something that came into effect in 1994. This is kind of your worst case scenario. We do not anticipate needing this many. And I can tell you currently we have two interns hired in special ed, and we have one high school teacher who's working on her health credential. She is a credentialed PE teacher, so for that portion of her job, she falls under this. So this is really a worst case scenario, if you will, and the reason we elevate these numbers a bit is so that I don't have to bring this back to you if I didn't put enough on here, but our goal is, of course, to have highly qualified teachers in every classroom. So I bring forth as a recommendation to approve.
Are there any questions from the board?
Just to try to get
comments
the right
from the
place
public.
Here.
The recommendation is to accept the declaration for elementary and high school districts.
Move approval.
Thank you.
Okay.
Student recommendation?
Aye.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain?
Got it.
7-0. Thank you.
And
thank you.
And it's a wrap.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, ma'am.